Our crowdfunder is nearly over, so a huge thank you to our long list of donors, who are the mysterious Mr. PYO, Gary and Mary Nurse, 99 star player Matt Nurse, Cora Cahill, Julian Parrin, Ione Layla McBean, Deb Woods, Liam Almy, aka Lime Regis, Rondell Stabana, Pavan Singh, Stoke City's Alison Hall, The Rainbow Peppermill, aka James Morris, aka The J-Trix, Ben Carvell, Sally Hall, Leslie and Malcolm Hall, Dan P, Doyle Norris, Nana Woods, and friend of the show, Adam Grewcock, and not forgetting the man who started it all, Liam Phillips. There's still a little bit of time to donate to our crowdfunder if you're listening on Wednesday or Thursday. You can find the link on our Instagram, at the99srugby, or our website at www.the99rugby.com. You can also donate to our PayPal account if you missed the crowdfunder. Just click the button on our website, and it is my birthday this week, so why not drop us a little gift? Also, don't forget to check out the Yarder Collective for some alcohol-free beers, spirits and ciders, amongst other things. You can get 5% off any order over £10 by using the discount code 99rugby24. And you can find them at www.yardercollective.co.uk, and there's a link on our website. Enjoy this week's show. It's something a little bit different, a bit more of a personal one for me and Dan. So we hope you enjoy it. Thank you, and here's the show.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the 99's Rugby Podcast, the podcast that talks about ice cream as well as rugby. Not too much ice cream. And whether you stand with Israel or Palestine, we can all agree ice cream is good. So can't we all just come together and agree on something here? The hate got to stop. Both sides of the coin.
Is that not a bit above our station? I mean, I agree. It's your piece is really what everybody wants in this situation. Are we the ones to be... Fuck it, yes. We're calling for peace in Israel and Palestine. We can all... Everyone can... As much as it's very hot in that part of the world, maybe ice cream melts quite quickly, but a similar dessert, we can all rally around. What's a good Middle Eastern dessert? Baklava. We can all have a nice there.
Baklava, so ice cream.
Yeah, why not? If you've seen a bowl already...
Exactly. And maybe some profiteroles or something like that. That seems like a nice, peaceful dessert. Bit of cream, bit of pastry, bit of chocolate.
No one's ever had a bowl of profiteroles and been angry about it afterwards.
Exactly.
So
let's get some rugby down there, get some ice cream down there. Everyone will be happy. And that's all I'm saying. So if you're listening to this, leaders of both concerned parties or anyone who's out there getting pissed off, we just want you all to get along and we hope that one day you can. And cheers to that, Dave. What are you drinking this week, buddy?
Cheers. I've got not a non-alcoholic beer this week. However, some would call this unorthodox for a late Sunday evening drink, but I've got ultimately a non-alcoholic, I guess it's a non-alcoholic sort of spirit, really. It's a Liars, sort of Y, not L-I-A-R, it's L-Y-R-E. Italian orange non-alcoholic spirit. It is reminiscent of something kind of like an Aperol, something like that. And I've got that and tonic with a slice of lemon and ice. Very, very refreshing.
That's good. How does it compare to an alcoholic version of something similar?
Personally, I think it's tastier than like a gin and tonic.
Bold.
Because gin doesn't taste very nice, to be honest. You need to have it with tonic, which kind of just makes it... And lime, or lemon.
That's just citrus fruit of choice. That is pure bitterness.
It's a very bitter drink. And
like a horrible stepmom of a drink.
It truly is. It's the kind of thing, it marries your dad for his money. And then...
You know.
And just treats you... Very poor. He tries to get you written out of the will. That's what a gin and tonic is. Whereas this is the fun stepdad that takes you to do dangerous extreme sports.
And paintball.
Yes, paintball, skateboarding, probably has a season ticket to NASCAR, and has the best seat where you might catch a tire and or driver's head that's come dislodged. It's very, very nice. It's an adult sort of sweetness to it. It's not like pop. It is, I mean, obviously it's got tonic in, so it's got a touch of that bitterness to it, but it's like a kind of zesty floral kind of flavor to it. So botanical, you might even say.
Two questions, Dav. Would you recommend it? And if someone was interested in getting their hands on some layers, where would they get it?
I would recommend it. It is genuinely, like, if you're at like a barbecue or, you know, any event where people are drinking and you don't want to drink and you don't want pop or soft drinks, if you don't, you know, too posh use the word pop, then it's the perfect thing. It's not like, and you're like, have you ever had Schlur or similar drinks that are like,
yeah.
Tries to be like a replacement for wine. They are basically just pop. This isn't like that at all. It's quite subtle. And no one would know if you come out of a glass. This people, you know, if you've got those kind of bad friends who go, "Well, why are you drinking?" And you got this, they just think it's probably just gin and tonic. They wouldn't know.
A classic.
And also, I don't know if you can see it on the camera, but because it's Italian inspired, it's got a Roman sort of logo. It's got a wolf dressed as a Roman soldier. So that's
very cool. That is very cool.
Liars, I believe they're an Australian company, but you don't have to go all the way to Australia to get your Italian orange and non-alcoholic spirits, because you can get them from the Yarder Collective. Only in Derby. If you're in Australia already, as some of our listeners are, then, you know, you're good. get it straight from the source. But
this is a terrible advertisement you're doing today. Just get to the point. Say what the fucking discount code is and where they can get it. Jesus Christ.
Wow, I was so forcefully and rudely instructed by my colleague. You can get a discount at the Yarder Collective. Enter the code 99rugby24 and you can get 5% off any orders over £10. You can also, you find them at www.yardercollective.co.uk or find the link on our website, www.the99srugby.com. What are you drinking, Daniel?
I've kept it a little bit, you know, relaxed this week. I've been watching a lot of rugby for once, actually. Watched games consistently Friday, Saturday and Sunday, which is very good for me. A mixture of games as well. Saw a little bit of Premiership rugby, saw some MLR today and stuff like that. So I've been enjoying a couple of sort of lagers alongside that, you know, sort of a bit more blokey, a bit laddie, you know, chilling with none of the boys because, you know, hard to get the people around in these COVID times. But enjoyed a few Heineken Blues, the 0% alcohol Heinekens. Again, available at the Yarder Collective. You can order yourself quite a big box of those, I believe. They do a large 12-pack, I believe, possibly. Don't hold me to that. I might be wrong, but you can get a few at least anyway. It's quite nice. It's close to the real thing. You know, it's actually, again, it's kind of nice in a way, like you said before, about your beverage tasting better than regular gin. It's kind of nicer than a lager because it's nowhere near as gassy. So it's, in a way, it's kind of nice and enjoyable. So if you enjoy the taste of lager but don't want the gas, the bloat or the hangover, get yourself some of these Heinekens. There are other non-alcoholic lagers available, though. Don't just take my word for it. Get yourself to the Yarder Collective. See what they've got. There's a whole range of them. And ciders as well. But,
truly have it all.
Mm. Big week, by the way, for us. It's kind of like a joint one this week because we've both been heavily involved in these things. Obviously, training continues across the country, you know, coaching down here. It's been great to see people getting back and enjoying their rugby, a little bit of pre-season work. Watching some youth rugby again today in less than enjoyable conditions. It was sidewards rain the whole time I was there, but, you know, great to see some youth rugby happening again, including some under-15s action. Big shout out to them on a good result as well. But yeah, big week for the 99s. The squad is fully assembled. Everyone's locked in. We're locked in for 3 tournaments. And the kit order is off. We're expecting our kit in the coming weeks to get the boys looking sharp.
And not only that, we've got sponsors. We have fooled people into giving us money for shameless advertising. We'll get all the details confirmed. But as of next week, I'm sure... hear us plugging them shamelessly.
Expect some tacky advertisements, some in-pod adverts. We might break away from the action for a second.
Yeah.
Might have some really tacky stuff like, hey, Dave, have you heard about this new product? And we have a bit of back and forth.
That boy, kind of have I.
You hate. That kind of stuff that you as a listener hates. Well, expect some of that coming your way.
Hey, Dan, do you hate it when you really need a certain product, but you just don't have it to hand?
Do you know what, Dave? I really do.
Well,
how can I help myself out?
Yeah, have I got the perfect thing for you? I know just the good and or service that would help you out.
Oh my word, that's the kind of level of cheese you guys can expect in the coming weeks. But really excited. Yeah, you know, really excited. There's some great sponsors on that list as well. Really excited to sort of work with these people, see what we can do to help maybe raise the profile for their brand, as well as also, like you've said, take advantage of that money coming on. The kit's going to be embossed with some great logos. So, yeah, keep an eye out for them because we're plugging them on social media as well, I'm sure. So big thank you to all of those people. You know who you are already. And we'll be talking to you this coming week about what we can do. But, yeah. Other than that, it's been relatively a quieter week in the rugby world after the sort of Lions announcement hangover, I guess. But there's a couple of headlines to look at. You know, the first of which, Kieran Reid has hung up the boots, even though probably most people would have thought he already had done already. But he's been on a all expenses paid holiday in Japan for the last sort of few months.
He's been, I don't know, who was he playing for in Japan, actually? Toyota Verblitz. So he's been around the Toyota factory making a few cars, I'm sure, lending a hand there. Maybe, you know, a bit of, oh, your dinner's done, Daniel. I'll fill in expertly. So yeah, down at Toyota, I'm sure he's, you know, in the R&D department, bit of manufacturing as well, all that good Toyota goodness. But yeah, finally hands with boots for my money. The best number 8 ever to pull on the jersey just embodies it all: leadership, ability, you know, sort of gritty forward play, skill, truly the full package.
Yeah, he's definitely in anyone's top three, isn't he? He has to be.
Yeah, I think I would go as far to say the best player I think I've seen in my time. I think. As much as someone like Richie McCaw is probably, again, he's one of those players up there in that level. I think Reid had a bit more of like an all-round game, like a more attacking game. Just, and it always seems to be anyway, a really, really nice bloke. Maybe he's just a good media man. Maybe he's an arsehole in real life. Who knows? Never met him. But
I'd remember him getting pissy with Romain Poix on the last Lions tour about that the decision. Yeah, and then him and Sam Warburton awkwardly sharing the trophy.
Yeah, in my opinion, he rightfully got pissy because, like I said, I think I said last week, offside is offside. It doesn't matter if it's the last minute of the game or if it was accidental. You cannot catch the ball after a knock on. It's offside. Should have been a penalty, but never mind.
Yeah, so a change in life for Kieran Reid, and then also a few changes going on in the world of ruggers. A big change for England. Simon Amor and Riles are leaving Eddie Jones's coaching staff. Bit of change following the sort of post Six Nations assessment they did. It seems like some decisions have been made, some faces will be changing. So that's interesting. And also this week, Eddie's been on another visit, one of his famous visits. He's been with Hull FC. Interesting. Where do you stand on these kind of trips? Obviously, you know, first off, there's been a change in the England staff. We don't know too much about that. You know, the rumours will be what they be. There's not really much we can say about it. It'll be interesting to see who comes into those roles, especially the sort of skills and attacking coach like Amor did hold up a sevens guy by trade. He didn't perhaps maybe make the impact they expected, but an interesting assignment. It was all in for him, I guess, and he's probably learned a lot from it. But yeah, has Eddie learned anything from Hull FC, do you think?
I'm assuming that's Hull FC, the rugby league side, not the football club.
No, it's not Hull City, not the Tigers, no. Yeah, it's
Hull FC. I mean, there's always something to be learned. I think rugby league and rugby union probably don't do enough cross-code learning off each other, because I think, you got to remember that I don't know if he necessarily would have learned that much. It's not like Hull a groundbreaking side in Super League. I think, certainly in the modern professional era, the games, I think there's less to learn. I think obviously 20 years ago, 25 years ago, there was a lot that was learned from rugby league in terms of professionalism in a code of rugby. I don't know. I'm sure there's always good, I think, to see what other people are doing in other sports. I think see what you can learn. I think it's stupid to think that, oh, only your sport matters. Like, there's a lot that can be taken. I'm sure Eddie Jones would get plenty out of going to, you know, see football clubs to go and see, you know, maybe they wouldn't let him probably because he's England coach, but he went to see Gaelic football over in Ireland.
Yeah, he's famously been in with Pep Guardiola before when Guardiola was at Bayern Munich, wasn't he? He was in there with him then. I think, you know, Eddie Jones is kind of like a really man management kind of guy as well, isn't he? That's his set as the coach. So I think he's probably taken a lot of that stuff from people. I mean, Guardiola's hailed as one of the great man managers in football at the moment, isn't he? And great sort of coaches from afar in a way, like the way he coaches players in terms of being better people, which translates into their football a little bit, I guess would be a way to put it. So maybe he's picking that stuff up. But yeah, I mean, there's not too much coverage on. I mean, rugby coverage at times is notoriously poor in terms of when these things happen. It's literally just a headline and they'll say, oh yeah, Eddie's been to see them. But yeah, I mean, and the only sort of quote I've got really, he's got different ideas about high performance. Steve Price, the head coach, had said previously, so they, when he went to see Warrington. So I guess it's maybe the same sort of thing that you're saying. Any training techers or gym work you can take? I think, isn't it?
You think how many different professional clubs there are in the country across all sports? There's going to be interesting takes you can probably take from anything. It doesn't have to necessarily be even that sport specific. It could be more of a psychological thing. It could be, you know, that like team management, team building thing. It could be, like I say, a psychology thing. It could be a training regime. You don't know exactly what it is they're going for. I'm sure Eddie would have gone knowing what he wanted to get out of it. Generally speaking, I'm an Eddie Jones fan. People give him a hard time for how he sort of seems to pick his squads, you know, almost despite the media, which is maybe a valid criticism. I think he knows what he's doing most of the time. In terms of the coaching departures, I mean, I don't know. I think he's chopped and changed his team almost all the time. It's not like it's a shock to see these people leaving. I think he seems to keep that side of things fresh. In terms of England coaches, he seems to be the one who has certainly in recent years has been looking to just keep, maybe that's his style. He's kind of a big picture guy. So as I say, moving over, man manager gets the players to do their best, but in terms of, I think manages the coaching team he's got a lot, and obviously I think maybe just keeping those ideas fresh. I think, you know, we've got a couple of years to the next World Cup. If, you know, maybe had those, I think because he had a couple of guys he brought in, I think because the guys he wanted couldn't be there for COVID reasons, etc. And maybe he's got other people lined up, or maybe he's just thought those guys have imparted their wisdom.
Yeah, I think that's the point of it, isn't it? You know, you don't have to
new
have
ideas to come in.
You don't have to have them there forever, do you? You know, they don't have to be a permanent feature. You can have them in there for one tournament, get your learning from them, and then go, okay, we've learned what we can from you. It's kind of, I guess, much like, you know, fighters sometimes, don't they? Like, especially in MMA, well, you know, because there's so many techniques to know, and in rugby, unlike, I guess, you know, football's not basic by any stretch, you can learn a lot, but in terms of like the actual skills are quite limited. You know, you can pass and you know, do footwork and stuff like that, but rugby's got, you know, things like rucking, mauling that every player on the pitch has to be able to do to some degree, goal kicking and such potentially as well for a lot of players. So there's a lot of things to learn, and much like I say with those martial arts fighters who need to maybe add jiu-jitsu or Muay Thai to their game to sort of develop onto a new level and open up a different capacity for their competition, it's kind of, maybe that's the way he's approaching it, really. You know, you have your basics as boxing, which might be the way England attack is how Eddie has instilled it. And then you add in a bit of, like I say, jiu-jitsu here and there, maybe some wrestling in one or two training camps. And you've got those feathers in your cap then, and you can use them when you need to. Maybe that's how he looks at it. You're probably right there.
Yeah, I think as well, he's got his sort of permanence. Like John Mitchell's been there for a while. You think of someone like Gatland had Sean Edmonds at Wales forever and ever. And obviously he's moved on now, but obviously, I mean, defence is one of those things that isn't really ever changing, but certainly I think on the with the ball side of things. Like, it's not like players forget what they're learning. I think attack, certainly at professional level, really, attack shouldn't be super, like, drilled. You need to let those players play. And I think maybe that's probably maybe a good way to rotate it and get, say, skills coach, attack coaches coming in and trying new things, developing those skills. I mean, realistically, once they're developed at a professional level, you're not going to forget them. It's not like, you know, they're bringing in and, like, I don't know, they learn to play the piano for 8 weeks, they get good at the piano, they never touch it again. Like, you come in and learn a few new skills, a new way, a few ways of thinking in a, you know, a Six Nations cycle or whatever, and that guy then moves on. Like, you know, you keep that with him, you're still playing rugby every day, it's not something you're going to forget. And unless you get someone who comes in to literally coach what the last guy did out of you, which I assume is not going to be the plan, it's going to be beneficial long term. So I don't think there's anything too much in it. I don't think it's like Eddie Jones blaming these people for a bad Six Nations. I think it's just the way he does things.
Yeah, yeah, and I think that's an interesting take on him. And I think it's, we'll see how it plays out. You know, we've got autumn internationals, I guess, coming up at some point if teams are allowed to come. So we'll see how they go then. That'll be the next time we see, I guess. But what we will see some international rugby of, last bit of news that we'll cover, I guess, before we get onto our main topic for today. But because we don't talk about the scores and stuff like that. If you want that kind of stuff, either go to Teletext or listen to other podcasts, because we're not here to talk about all the Prem scores and stuff like that too much. It's a good weekend of Prem, don't get me wrong. Some interesting results. But the sort of last bit of bigger news, I guess, in this quieter week kind of thing is the Lions are going to face the Lions is the headline, really, that I've been seeing a lot. Everyone's trying to big that up and try to make it a bit more exciting than it is. But the tour schedule has been finalised and confirmed, I guess. So
it's been fairly well altered since last week. I did say it was odd that they weren't playing the Lions last week. If we did an actually Lions-centric podcast, that is to say the British Irish Lions playing the quote-unquote Emirates Lions, the Johannesburg Super Rugby team, formerly Super Rugby by the looks of things. They replacing the Invitational 15 game on the grounds that bringing in a lot of players from abroad would be unsafe, which I can understand. I don't think it's good for the tour. I think that was probably the most interesting midweek game, and it's now not happening, but I understand why. One thing they have done, though, is really limited as to where they're playing the games now. And this is something that, for me, takes a little bit away. Obviously, they're playing the Lions at Ellis Park in Johannesburg, which is actually their home ground. They're then playing the Sharks at Ellis Park, which is not their ground. I don't know. It's, what's the point of playing these teams if you're not playing? The whole point is to play them in their own backyard. It's, I get why they have to do it, but they're only playing at three stadiums now, I think. Three or four. I get why it has to happen, but it feels a bit of a sanitized, literally in this case, sanitized tour. Yeah.
It just feels like, yeah, like it's almost like we're just taking a select team. It doesn't feel like a tour anymore, really. And it's a shame for it. Like you say, we understand why, but will it stop me from watching it? Probably not, because it will be on.
I mean,
we'll be enjoying it, but it stops me maybe from feeling quite the same way about it. And I think that's how a lot of people will be looking at this. They'll be keen to watch the games, but
I think we'll look back on this in the future as being kind of like a lost tour. Like, it'll be that kind of missing tour that happened, but it was not quite maybe what it could and or should have been.
I know the sad thing is, sorry for me as well, is, you know, we spoke about that show last week where everyone was talking about how the old annoying people, to put it in the nicest term, was talking about how great it is to be a Lion and all that. I mean, do you feel like it cheapens it for these guys a little bit now? Like, it's rubbish, isn't it? Because, like, you've been picked and all that, and I imagine these guys feel amazing for it. We saw the celebrations for, you know, Reece Amit, for example, and that at Chris Harris at Gloucester. Those are amazing scenes. But, like, does it kind of cheapen it a little bit? Does it feel less important? Do you think the guys are going to struggle maybe to have the same feeling about it because it is so, to quote you, sanitized and, like, watered down? Or will it still mean enough, do you think? I think that's the biggest question here.
I think it will definitely will still mean a lot to the players, because it is still the team that's been, you know, picked. It's still the but they are, in quotes, the best, well, 37 or whatever it is that's ended up being picked. So I think it means plenty for them still. I guess a take on just going back to sort of the squad pick, and I saw an interesting video. I imagine a lot of you probably have watched Squidge Rugby, and he's always has very interesting takes. For my money, he's much more interesting to listen to than most of the professional pundits. I suppose he is a professional pundit in a lot of ways, but, you know, he's never played the game to much of a standard. He basically saying how he's breaking down how the squad is built around sort of how they're going to go and play. And I kind of felt like conflicted. I think he's probably right. Like, that is why the squad's been picked. And he says it's not necessarily the best player. And there's a couple of funny jokes about basically Elliot Daly and Bundiaki being crap in the Six Nations. And I kind of think, is that what the line should be? I don't know. Should it be just the best players possible? Or should it be a team that's, quote unquote, got a game plan to go and win? Because it's an invitational team. It's not like a test team. I think if you're picking nations, if you're picking the Wales or the England squad to go and play South Africa, and you go, well, okay, we're going to pick the team that will go and beat South Africa for an every 4 years special event. I don't think it's fair for players to miss out who are better than the players that are in the squad because you've got a plan. I don't know.
But this is the problem, is that the tour has changed now. It is more about winning than it was before, because if you hear these like people talk about historically about the Lions, they're like, they love the Lions coming because we always used to beat them. That's kind of the quotes you hear. Like, the Lions would struggle. They didn't really win all that often. And a tour win was actually like really special. Whereas now, to a degree, it's not expected, but it's definitely more expectation on us going and winning a tour. You know, the last time we toured South Africa, it was close. It was good. It was the most epic three-match series I think anyone's ever seen and probably ever will see in our lifetime. So I guess the expectation is that it's at that level. But you hear people talk, and that is the thing that they say. We're picking the team to go and beat South Africa because I guess that's what people want. And, yeah, I think we just want to see good games more than anything in a fan's perspective. But a tour win is nice as well. So it is kind of like you've got to pick the team to win, haven't you? It's, you know, like week to week in the league, you want to win your games. So it's the same sort of thing, I guess. But yeah, I guess enough of that for now. We've said our piece on it. We'll see how it goes. At least the tour is going ahead to a degree. And I think the test matches become even more important now that the midweek games have lost most of their value, I guess, with that kind of stuff. So I do feel a bit bad for those guys who are going to be the midweek warriors. But yeah, it's going to be a real big series now. I think it needs to be three very good games to save this series in people's minds, I guess, and going forward. So good luck to the boys from both teams putting on a bit of a spectacle. If they can match the level of that second test in 2009, I mean, even half of that will be in for a good three-match series. So that would be the challenge, I guess, overall. Before we move on to our main topic, Dave, do you want to talk about the Rainbow Cup from the weekend?
I do not.
Good, me neither.
I mean, I look from the seeing the scores. They're like, they're probably interesting games. I just do not care.
I don't care
in the slightest. I just think the whole thing's a waste of time. Right. I mean, as we move on to the main topic, something a little bit different this week, I guess. We spoke a lot about the game of rugby at large. I suppose we have had a pretty wide range of topics.
We have.
A little bit more personal this week, though. Sort of talking about our own journeys, kind of go through why and how and you know, sort of everything about how we got into rugby and what we've taken from it, why the game means so much to us now, why we felt compelled to kind of, you know, move on to doing what we're doing, I guess, and putting this out on the internet for everyone to sort of listen to and, I guess, criticise us if they want. But, you know, it's a game we feel passionate about. We've probably come out with some pretty strong opinions already in, like, 10 episodes. So, yeah, I guess that is the what we're talking about. So I guess you want me to start off, Daniel?
Yeah, I mean, how do you want to do this? Do you want to just spiel it off or ask questions? How do we do this? It's an interesting take for us, really, to be fair, to talk about. I mean, I guess first and foremost, what might be interesting is if we do handle it a bit like that. So, yeah, what's the reason you got into the game? And sort of, I guess we can both give our kind of take on that, and then our journey will come out of that, I guess, and people get a bit of an idea, like you say, about us. So, yeah, when and why did you start playing the glorious game of Rugby Union?
To be honest, I guess it's all down to my mum, really. Hello, mum, I know you listen. My mum became a fan of rugby in the 70s with the great Welsh team of that time. To what extent it was that she just fancied Phil Bennett, I don't know. But it was... that was why she used to like watching that team. Obviously, my mum is half Welsh and supports... She's to this day supports Wales. From that, I guess she took my oldest brother down, who has coached both of us, and my second oldest brother as well. And to be honest, he's coached most of the 99s.
Yeah, a good portion of them, for sure.
My mum and then my oldest brother, Phil, who I don't think listens, but, you know,
still fuck a big you shout if you're out. Listening.
And he coached my older brother, Matt, who is a 99, who also listens, who first name drop for you, I think, Matt, but I know you're listening, and will be playing for us this summer. So when I was it's one of my earliest memories of being like a young kid, was, you know, like Phil coming round to, you know, he'd take Matt out to go and coach him on a Sunday, and he used to play. He spent a lot of time going, going following Hinkley Rugby Club to go and watch my brother play for them back in the day. Used to go all over the place as well, across the Midlands. And that was kind of how it started, and started playing myself from the tender age of 5 years old, possibly even younger, actually. Went down to Obi Wigs, a local club, really, for where I am. And I remember, don't really remember much about when I first ever started playing. I do know that I played with Harlequin's, well, Legends is a massive push, but Harlequin's player of the past, Charlie Walker, was in the first team I ever played rugby with. He plays in Italy now. But yeah, and I remember I got under fives player of the season, and it kind of followed on from there. I started playing, it's all I've ever known, really, since I was a wee child, really, like right from the very sort of start when I was at school, like as young as possible, I was there. And I sort of never stopped, really, and carried on all the way through my youth. So I guess I owe everything, I guess, to my mum and to my brother, really, in terms of rugby related, at least. And we've been a rugby family, and yeah, that's how it started for me. What about your good self? And you have quite a different sort of rugby start.
A lot more of a late bloomer in that regard, I guess. My mum and dad, I mean, I was quite difficult. I broke my leg when I was like three or four. And it meant I had a really underdeveloped left leg. So when I was a kid, I had a bit of a limp, like a bit of a bad limp. I had my left leg was like way skinnier and less developed muscular-wise than my right leg. So I had a bit of a limp for a long time until I was like literally like maybe 9 or 10. And then I sort of grew a little bit and it caught up. You get like a growth spurt and it caught back up and stuff like that. And I got a bit of a normal gait then. I went from having a bit of a drag leg, a bit of a club foot almost, to having a nice stride, a more regular sort of gait pattern, I guess. So I was never really pushed into playing sport. My dad never like dragged me and my brother down and so that, but he got into go-kart and he went quite far and all that kind of sort of motor racing, driving and all that sort of stuff. So that was how I spent like my formative years following him around, which like you with your brothers, but it just never twigged for me. And then what I really wanted to be a boxer. So when I did start getting a bit more athletically capable, and stuff like that. I actually really wanted to be a boxer. I tried a few things. I tried like guitar and stuff like that, and it never really worked out. But I just wanted to actually be a boxer. I had a lot of like anger anyway as a kid. I used to have to like anger management when I was in like year 5 and 6. Just headbutt tables, be a right fucking nightmare of a kid. I was dreadful for that kind of stuff. So I needed that kind of outlet, I guess. And because I hadn't had it previously, I guess it built up like that. So it was really trying to find something. I was desperate to be a boxer. I went to a few sessions at the local amateur club and stuff like that, and really did enjoy it. And it's something that I've never stopped doing. It's always been my dream job, actually, was to be a boxer. That's what I wanted to be when I was a kid. But my mum was really sort of against it. I'm like the youngest child, so I'm like the little baby, you know, got to be protected and bubble wrapped. And she sort of thought, is there anything else she could get into and stuff like that? And then a friend, we played rugby at school. So I went to my high school. We played rugby like in PE and stuff like that. I thought, this is all right. And I was better at it than football. And then a friend said, well, do you want to come down to Hinckley Rugby Club, the local club? So it's sort of like 12, 13. I came down to Hinckley Rugby Club and met the man sat on the opposite end of this call, a young David Nurse back in the day. Our first training session, my mum and dad, like amazing, supporting everything. They took me down to the local sports shop, Mr. Sports, as it was in Ilshilton, along the Holler, the sort of main road that goes through the town there. And yeah, got me all kitted out, like Lycra underlayer, the shorts, the samurai, all the samurai gear, and a cougar top and all that. I remember I rocked up to the first session and you said, I look like Dan Carter. And I didn't even know who the fuck Dan Carter was. I had absolutely no idea what you're on about. I was like, who the fuck is that? I don't know who that is, but cheers. He must be a pretty good looking guy. I've seen myself in the mirror. I'm looking good. So
this is what, so weird that you remember that, actually, because I remember your first session. I remember saying that to you as well.
Yeah.
That sort of like, you've got like a kind of dark complexion and you've got like dark hair.
Olive skinned, you might say.
Yeah, and you have that look of kind of a Kiwi look about you for a 12-year-old boy at the time. But yeah. I remember that. It's weird as well. I remember your first ever session. I remember, I think we were kind of got on well from the beginning, from what I remember.
Oh, yeah. No, we've always been friends since then, really.
Yeah, I remember from the moment you joined, it was both fucking weird, probably why.
Yeah. But it's like what? It's like 13 years on, maybe more, maybe nearly 14 years on.
I think we've known each other, say, longer now than we haven't, which is, and been friends. We've always, say, have been close friends, which is, I guess part of my rugby career as well. I was always very shy growing up, still am to a certain extent. You know, not very confident when I start, you know, when I meet people. I've always been quite a shy person, but me and you have always got on well. It's just such a weird thing. This is kind of just us like having like a bro time, but recording it from the internet.
Yeah, but this is what it's all about with the game. And you make these friendships, you know, like, and I know, you know, like I say, you started off at Wigs there, but then there's guys who at Hinckley had started off at that age group as well. They were like 5, who are still friends now and are friends with us as well. And some of them are playing in the 99s, guys who have been in that kind of bracket. So there were guys who started right off at 5 and you do sort of make friends for life. And unfortunately, the sad thing is a lot of the time, maybe it's like the background we came from a little bit more in terms of like sort of maybe more working class state school educators. You lose a lot of those guys to certain things. You know, we lost a few of those people who were in our team with us to sort of, you know, falling in with the wrong crowd and stuff like that. And those things happen as well, and it just shows you, like, I think it's quite special to keep those bonds in life in general, but I think something like sport really does tie you together because of what you go through, and like especially as young men. Like I was out there today watching our under 15s team here at Honiton, and just like really, really good bunch of lads, and I saw a lot of us in them, you know what I mean, because it wasn't that long ago, it was 10 years plus ago now, but it wasn't that long ago we were that kind of age. And some of the parents sort of saying to me, oh yeah, these, you know, they're a bit naughty now. They sort of try and go out the night before a game or nick a few beers or whatever. I'm like, that's exactly what I was doing. I got so much time for that because, you know, you make the great friends like that. But yeah, I think that's the next part of the story, I guess, talking about those sort of 7 years we spent playing together, 7 or 8 years before we moved on and went off to different unis and all that kind of stuff, really. So yeah, I started in, was it 2008? It would have been. Hinckley, and we would have been under 12s. I came right in at the end of the season under 12s, and we went to Burnham on Sea, and that's where I have my great memories of your older brother Phil rocking cheeky Vimtos after the tournament. I remember everything about that tournament. I knocked the ball on over the line against Lincoln in the group.
There's a great picture There's a really
looks like I've scored an amazing try.
Really great pitch of you like halfway diving over the line, and we all know the truth where you fumbled it. Back in the day, you were well known for having bad stumps for hands, essentially.
I played on the wing as well.
Quick, hard runner, very. Almost seemed random as whether you catch the ball or not.
Yeah, it was better picking up a loose ball and going from there rather than being past it.
So just, again, us being good friends, I remember that tour as well, turning up and getting it. I think because my dad and my brother, Phil, are both teachers. So we had to leave a little bit later than everyone else. They had to finish off on the Friday doing whatever work teachers do after 3 o'clock. I don't know. I'd go home if it was me, but I'm not gonna judge. I remember getting out of the car and then like you running over and like jumping up give me a hug. It was one of those weird memories I have. It's just like, I don't know, it means a lot to me. Oh, my good friend Daniel.
That was a really good tour, man. I remember that. Yeah, I remember you're over a field drinking the Cheeky Vimto's after the post tournament stuff. We got to the final. I remember this now. We got to the final. We played Lincoln, who was like known to us a bit. I mean, I'd only been playing for like a month at this point. I remember, and this is the great thing about rugby again. Like, I'd only been going down for a few weeks. Mum and dad like didn't know any of the parents, but everyone was so welcoming. And then out of nowhere, we just got like a letter shoved in our face by sort of the Steves, who are our coaches at that point, and just sort of saying, we're going to Burnham on Sea in a few weeks as a space if you want it, the sort of April Easter weekend or something like that. Are you going to come? And mum and dad were like, do you want to go? And that was it. And that was it then. And that's what got me, because we played and it was great. It was enjoyable. I enjoyed the playing because I was getting into sport massively then. But the thing that sold me, I said, I really want to stick with this group, and that is the social afterwards. It was just fun. We were like 30s. We weren't drinking loads. We were like a stubby, and that's it. You get even like one stubby and that's it. But like, you know, your brother was there having a bit of a great time with the shades on, chugging some Cheeky Vimto's and all that, and all the parents were having a good time, and it was just great fun, barbecues and all that, and the sun. And I was just like, do you know what? If this is what life is going to be like, if I do this, I'm in. Because I'd never felt that with anything else I'd done, like with boxing or football or anything. I just didn't quite get that social element to it, or even playing instruments and stuff. But I got it with rugby straight away. I was like, this is what it's about, and this is what I enjoy. And it kept me in the game and kept me ever since.
Yeah, it seems to be something that is kind of unique to rugby. I'm not sure if it's just like built in as part of like the fabric of the game, and that kind of tradition just gets passed down from like, say, with it on tours, it's dads down to sons, and that kind of passes as they grow up, and then as you get older and it goes to like from senior players down to colts or whatever. But there is that kind of social aspect to rugby that I don't see in a lot of other sports quite the same way. Like people I know who play football, it's kind of like that's not part of it. Like obviously if you play Sunday League football, like there's not quite the same thing. Maybe it's just because rugby clubs have their clubhouses and everything is very different to something. Maybe the football's a bit more like it's on the park. It's there's no opportunity to easily socialise. I played cricket this weekend, sort of starting to get into that as well. And that was, again, we played on ultimately like a local rec, and it was not quite the same. You couldn't quite go and do the same like clubhouse thing. I don't know, but the social aspect of rugby does seem to be kind of unique from what
I've seen. Yeah, it feels a lot more like the center of the community, doesn't it? Like a lot more like a pillar of the local community and stuff like that. And I think it's maybe it's those kind of like public school traditions of having like the nice clubhouse in there and stuff like that. But yeah, it's sort of I remember those tours. Those tours were always great. And let's be honest, they were an excuse for the parents to be on a bit of a booze cruise, because I thought was great, because they've got kids. You know, you don't want an expensive holiday every time you go away and all that. And we play rugby. It just made sense. It was like, we can go to this place. They could have the social element of having a weekend away. We could play rugby. They could get behind us and support us. But also, you meet people. And that was the greatest thing about rugby. And it just feels like any country you go, you can rock up to a clubhouse and get a game. And it feels like you can get in with people straight away just by saying those three words, I play rugby. People respond to it if they do as well. And you've got that kind of connection, even if you can't speak English, if you know, they can't speak English, or you can make that connection just through sport, through movement, through exercise. You know, it's it's great, and I love those tours. We had some good ones. We had some really good ones back then.
Well, you see, you talk about our tours. Well, the one that sticks out in my mind is when we went to Holland.
Yeah,
we were 14, I think, when we went.
And, yeah, it was under 14s.
And you talk about the parents. It's an excuse for them. The plan was we were playing a game against, I believe it was Gouda, was how we always said it. I believe it's pronounced Gouda in Dutch. The cheese is from there. You'd have seen it. We played there on the Saturday, I believe, and then there's a tournament on the Sunday.
I'm going to pull umbrage with that right now before you go any further. People have heard you say that. That's right. We used to fucking put on those tours. They were ridiculous. I remember the last one we did. We came down here actually. We came down to Cornwall, past Devon into Cornwall. We played County Champions Falmouth on the Saturday. Had a really good game, beat them. So we were technically Devon County Champions for a while.
Cornwall.
And then we played another game the next day on the Sunday. Another full 80. It was ridiculous, which we'll come back to in a second, I'm sure. But, back to Holland.
This is the parents ridiculous schedule, disgracing themselves and in many ways ruining their kids' fun. Because the plan was we would go play Gouda on the Saturday morning, had a bit of fun at the clubhouse afterwards, got to meet the Dutch players and tried to speak in broken English as well as they could. Much better English than our Dutch, let's be honest. Then we were going to go to Amsterdam, world-famous Amsterdam in the afternoon. Did we bollocks? All of the parents all got smashed. And we were at Gouda Rugby Club for about 5 hours, and it got to the point where we were all really, really bored because we were what,
beyond bored, man.
When there was nothing we couldn't do anything, and then all the parents were smashed.
It was bad.
So they ruined that tour.
That was great though, and I think the great thing about rugby before we actually no, let's finish off tours because I think this is a great point to make. But yeah, next tour, the tour after that was the under 15s tour to
the aforementioned Cornwall tour.
Yeah, which is 10 year anniversary of that. It was this weekend. 10 years. Really? Yeah.
How that feels.
That's
one of those things that feels like it was 10 years ago. But then, like, things that happened, like, literally about a year or two later feel to me like they were, like, 4 years ago and they're not. Like, 8 years ago now.
Yeah, we were lucky, man, to go on some great tours, I think, you know. Like, and that's the great thing about rugby, no matter whether you are, like, a working-class club, a working-class group of players or whatever, or you're a public school, it just makes sense to do these things. Like, going on tour and stuff like that was just great, and it felt... You know, it felt really interesting. But that Cornwall tour was a really interesting one. That was like where we were on the cusp of sort of manhood a little bit. Do you know what I mean? We were probably young men at that point. We were all like sort of 15 going on 21 sort of thing, I think. And the great thing about what I think those tours taught us and being in the clubhouse after games and stuff like that and the whole rugby thing is it teaches you life lessons that are really important. And I feel like you said before, like it's kind of, you know, it's got you to where you are now. It really has. And I think a lot of people would say that rugby's taught them a lot of stuff. It's taught me a lot of discipline and self-control and an avenue to release aggression and stuff like that and be positive with something, you know, use that energy for something positive, as well as also it's given me a bit of a career now. You know, it has. This is what I'm pushing to do career-wise, and it's given me something to follow and strive for. So, you know, I think you can't thank the game enough for that. But I remember those clubhouses and those tours doing court sessions and stuff like that. And you don't realize it at the time, but then when I got to uni and stuff like that, I was so comfortable in that environment of like running a court session, or if someone called me a fucking fresher cunt, I was like, oh, I'm used to being bullied. I know where I'm at now. My parents and other people's parents bullied me when I was 14 for what I looked like or what I did on the pitch. So I'm okay with it. And it really does. It builds that strong character. Yeah,
there's definitely a character building element. I think another important thing, we just want this Cornwall tour specifically as well, And many people talk, you know, like this masculinity thing as well. Mm. And I think there's a lot of confusion about sort of what like positive and toxic masculinity is. And obviously people try and frame like aggression as something that's not a good trait of masculinity, but it's like an inbuilt thing. It's, you can't do away with it. And obviously that Cornwall tour, we played Falmouth on the Saturday and we won. We played Redruth on the Sunday. Infamous in our circle as it basically erupted into a 30-man fight at one point. which I fully maintain was the referee's fault.
The bench is empty. The bench is empty.
It was a bench clearer.
Parents and, came onto the pitch. My dad came on shouting LAPD. He was that drunk. He was drunk still from like being at the Cornish Pirates game like the day before.
He was firing warning shots off in the air.
LAPD, LAPD.
Everybody on the ground.
Yeah. Everyone was like, what the fuck?
But no, and okay, that's not necessarily a positive thing to have happened. I appreciate that. And I'll go into this now. I'll just have my rant about refereeing now. Whenever that happens in a rugby match and it erupts into a fight, it is the referee's fault 100% of the time, every time. There's a little bit of niggling the game. He doesn't stamp it out. He's a little bit lenient. That kind of thing happens.
We'd had the warning, hadn't we? We'd had the warning. Oh, they're rough. And we're like, ah, that will be all right. We're hard. We're from the Midlands. And
actually, how hard can it be?
Yeah, shit at the fan.
But anyway, but after the game, after we've had this ridiculous scrap, A, the game wasn't cancelled. We calmed down. We carried on. We played. We finished the match. We then went in the clubhouse afterwards and had like a handshake and a little chat, did like the after-match presentation, as you would. And it's that important sort of like, and I think this is a very important lesson for anyone to learn, but I think especially young men, that, you know, you have your disagreements. Disagreeing is possibly an understatement for what happened, but you move on, you draw a line in it and you move on and you don't hold a grudge about it. And that's something that's important because we could very easily have said like, oh, they're a bunch of pricks or fucking we're just leaving. But no, like, and to be fair to them, they were gracious hosts after the game, after essentially violence. So, and that's a kind of important lesson. I think it's a big thing in rugby. It's that, you know, no matter what happens on the pitch, you know, you shake hands and you move on afterwards. And I've played in plenty of games since against much dirtier teams than that team as a man. And almost kind of learned to enjoy those kind of games in a way. There's nothing quite like gets you into a game of rugby than getting sort of punched in the face. Or
bit of edge, bit of needle, which sounds mental when people talk about that.
Kicked on the ground like that. And it kind of gets you into a game. And I'm not a dirty player by any stretch. That's an important part, I think. And it's something that's very hard, I think, to get in other sports. I think you see football, certainly low-level football as well. Like something like that kicks off and it's a very petty reaction to it. And have you ever seen like Sunday League footballers have a fight? They're throwing kicks, like little trying to shoo each other and like not really get involved. Whereas it's a weird thing. Like in a rugby fight, everyone stands up and sort of just like grab, it's more like a grab and a wrestle, and then some awful overhand misses than anything. Like, no one ever gets hurt. Very rarely.
Unless one of you guys is a black belt in judo and kickboxing. Then it ends very badly for a 6'5" second row. That's all I'm going to say on that one. No names there. Yes. He knows who he is. He knows who he is. Fucking knocks a guy clean out in that fight. That was unbelievable. That was the kind of stuff that would have got Joe Rogan going, on the mic in the UFC. It was a combination, hilarious, to say the least. A vicious two-punch combo. But this is what it teaches you overall, man. It's control overall, isn't it? Because we were 14, 15, and we were allowed to drink. When you say that to a lot of people, they go sort of like, what? You weren't like down the park every week, you know, which we all still did every now and then. Everyone was a little bit, you know, dodgy like that. We did what we could, but there was a lot of control. And like, it wasn't a big deal, like, to go in the clubhouse after the game and have a half pint of beer with a Mars bar stuck in it because you got dick of the day for, you know, dropping it or whatever. We learned all that kind of stuff then. Like, again, when you got to uni, that like, you felt a bit more responsibility for drinking and stuff like that, and you do have a little bit more control and a bit more awareness of yourself because, you know, you've had that there for you. And I think it just gives you that kind of structure overall, and again, it adds to that discipline, whether it's self-discipline or not. But I think it was important for us, like, again, coming from working class kind of hardish kind of area in some ways where it is easy to fuck about a little bit. I think it gave a lot of our guys something to sort of behave for, really.
Yeah, you know, definitely.
You didn't want to miss that game on a Sunday or a school game on a Saturday because you cared about the lads you were playing with and wanted to make it onto tour and stuff like that.
Yeah, and so I guess we move on from there as well to, I guess, our school days. So obviously, we both went to John Cleveland College, both out of catchment as well, actually. This is a kind of important story for both of us that
Obviously, yeah, both how us, different things could have been.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of dread to think what would have happened to me had I not ended up going there. It very easily could have gone different. So we, in theory, should have both gone to different schools. But my brother went to JCC. He played in the same team as Manu Tuolangi and Ryan Bauer, who are current professional players. Obviously, Manu, England, British and Irish Lion, sort of doesn't need an introduction. But there's so many legends of the game have gone to that school. And you think of, you know, I think we have briefly mentioned it in the past, but say the guys of Graham Rowntree, Dean Richards, Ollie Smith, Sam Vesti,
And successful athletes in other sports as well. Just quite a good state school for sport. And it was, everyone wanted to go there for that exact reason, especially if you played rugby. It was like, to go there.
Yeah, and it was the kind of school, I guess, to go to. If you were a rugby player, it was made a massive difference for us. But the allure of going there was something so important. And it definitely made a big change in the way I think I kind of saw rugby. I think it really pushed us outside of our comfort zone. And we weren't by any stretch a bad team at Hinckley, or even necessarily a good team at Hinckley, like in terms of Sunday club rugby. But I think definitely the opportunity was then there for the guys who wanted to really push on and try and improve themselves and get a lot out of it. And I think you could see when we first started there who kind of adapted to that.
And that's what I was saying earlier on. We lost a few guys, I think, because there was more. Not that Hinckley wasn't disciplined, because we had to behave and we worked hard. Like your brother and the Steves and Paul Welland, who coaches, worked as bloody hard, and we were fit, in good shape, and we had boundaries and that. But there's only so much you can do with other people's kids in that kind of space, I think. Whereas the school was literally, if you don't behave, if you don't play, if you don't turn up to training, you don't play. There was so much more control there. Don't care if you will score 5 or 6 tries a game. If you don't train, you don't have that level of commitment as the guy who's next to you, you don't play. He will play instead. And it was, and I think a lot of guys struggled with that when we got there. They did, you could see it. And it was because of, you know, like I say, the mixed backgrounds we had. It's something that, you know, people who are public school educated probably couldn't even fathom a little bit, in terms of like what we had as like a spectrum of player. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely. And if you look at what people who started off in that team when we were 14, and where some of them have gone since, and like, it's a ridiculous spectrum, like you say, of people. I mean, obviously a lot of public schools or private schools, anyone who's outside of the UK, you know, you have to play rugby. It's almost expected, if not even mandatory in some cases. And that's why some schools have like a 7th 15, whereas we, to be honest, by the time we finished, we would struggle to get out a second team. But like that, it was the teachers who were coaching us. It basically was like, you know, you behave and you sort of become a better person, I guess, or you're not going to be involved. And I think it's kind of sadly, I guess, a lot of people in our team kind of didn't really step up to it. And I guess it's that kind of thing, that traditional sort of problem you see in a lot of young lads, where they don't take well, I guess, to criticism, even like constructive criticism. And it was kind of like...
And rules and stuff like that.
When things got a little bit tough, it was a little bit harder than maybe, I don't know, they expected almost. I don't know. But we had a bit of a drop-off in players and we kind of struggled. But I think for the guys who stuck around, obviously, we got an awful lot out of it. It was a weird time, because obviously my brother's team, they had just won the Daily Mail Vars.
Yeah, sure. Like 2 years before we got there,
year before
we got there. The year we arrived, yeah.
If you can probably dig out footage, there's plenty of like replays of Manu Tuolangi scoring his first Twickenham try.
That was a big deal for a state school to win the Daily Mail Vars, you know, not the cup, but the Vars still. I mean, and I think they beat Hampton in the final, which again
is, and that result in itself, do you remember when we first went
down to London as a team, they played the first 15, played Hampton and beat them again, I think then.
did, yeah.
Our first year. So we'd set a, as a school, they'd set a precedent that, like, we were state school and we could, people we wouldn't have had a chance to play on a Sunday because we were playing, like, you know, Lutterworths or Lincoln, like across the Midlands, maybe Derby or Paviors, teams like this, you know, people will know these teams across the Midlands and stuff like that. But now we were getting a chance to, like, maybe go and play someone at Millfield.
Yeah.
Like, that's what we'd opened the door to. And I remember our first ever game at John Cleveland College, we played RGS High Wycombe at home.
And that's it, it's worlds apart from what we'd be used to. And there was a completely different kind of team.
We were used to scumbags like us on a Sunday, like the Midlands divisions. And then we were playing these guys on a Saturday. And that what those guys had done in the years before is, and you can't, and a lot of people didn't like him, let's be honest. A lot of people didn't react great to Haybrock and some of the other coaches and stuff. They didn't like the discipline, the fact you had to toe the line and stuff. And that was their loss, in my opinion. But you can't knock what that man did for that school, along with other people who, you know, there's probably too many names to mention, but he's just the one who was still there when we were there as the master in charge of rugby, which for a state school, they probably couldn't fathom having a job title like that for someone who's coaching rugby. It's normally just a bloke who likes rugby, just happens to be the PE teacher. He says, oh, let's get a team together and play the other local school and probably have a punch up or something like that. But him and, you know, the likes of Paul Walsh and other people had set up this almost dynasty in the last 20 years of, like, they started off in like the early 90s, getting pumped every week. And then year upon year, and he's told us the story, they lost slightly less and slightly less and slightly less until they beat a couple of the private and public schools. Then they started winning more and more. And then it culminates, obviously, in that winning a Daily Mail Cup. And that was something for us when we were like, shit, we need to go to this school. And like you said, we were lucky to get in from out of catchment because, and this is where rugby's helped me out in life a little bit, because we played rugby kind of creates that opening a little bit more, doesn't it? And then I know they messed up in the end anyway, and they had to let everyone in because the head teacher at the time said I'd let everyone in if I could. And someone went, well, you could if you wanted to. And then the school board went mad and then you had to let everyone in anyway. But you felt like the door opened a little bit more because you were committed to being part of something bigger than yourself.
Yeah. It's, I mean, like I said earlier, I dread to think where I probably would be without it. I mean, I was kind of lost at that age, really. I played rugby, like mini rugby as a kid, but like, I didn't have much direction at school. I didn't like school.
I hated school, man. The only thing that kept, you know, not to knock the teachers out of the school, but I just don't like learning in that environment. I didn't enjoy learning. I don't enjoy learning maths. You know, I feel like I've learned enough of that stuff in my life to get by to what I need to not fucking kill myself making a piece of toast. Do you know what I mean? I can function. But like, I didn't want to learn anymore. I was happy with what I'd learned. Do you know what I mean? And I only wanted to do sport. I was only interested in sport. And then I did get an interest in psychology doing A-level and stuff like that, which I've carried on. But like, I was only interested in very couple of things. The thing that kept me going through school and got me to pass my GCSEs with, you know, Bs and stuff like that was rugby, because I wanted to be part of this thing. So I wanted to do well across the board, because that was the idea at the school. You kind of were seen as not like a bastion of like, oh, these are the way to live, but kind of like, you know, if you're on the team, you got to do well. Do you know what I mean? You got to be committed. Yeah.
And it definitely gave me a reason to go to school as well. I remember this very distinctly being 13, 14 years old at high school or middle school, if you're in America, and thinking like, because you could leave school at 16 and like that, I was convinced I was going to leave school at 16. I was going to get out of school as soon as possible and do God knows what with my life.
Well, that's what my dad had. My dad left school at 15 and had a job on the Monday. That's what he said. He said, I left on the Friday. And he had two jobs. He had an apprenticeship and a sort of part-time job on the weekends. He's like, I had two jobs. And he's built up and done amazingly well.
Yeah.
And I sort of thought to myself, well, is that what I'm going to do? I don't want to learn. I never thought about going to university. Never thought about it.
Me neither.
But now I've got two degrees now. It's just, I wouldn't have that right now if I hadn't gone to that school. And I think people underestimate so little how important sport really is, and it's so important. And I look around and see where things are at, and people need it. We need it back in the school environment. State school especially needs that same to scale sort of thing that public schools have with sport, I think. And I think coming out of this COVID crisis, people need stuff, and kids especially will need stuff. I think sport needs to come back into these environments in a big way, because I know it's Hinckley Academy now. It's not even John Cleveland College anymore. They don't play rugby as far as I'm aware, or very little.
Yeah, which is such a shame. It's not the same like program that we had, and you hit the nail on the head. Like state school sport is really dependent on a handful of keen teachers. Not even PE staff necessarily want to try and run teams anymore. And it's really sad, and it's so important. It really, really is, because, like you said, for kids, I guess, who are like us, they need something to sort of keep them on the straight and narrow, because it's, there's no reason why I wouldn't have, like, you know, left school. If I'd have gone to the school I was meant to, like, I don't know. I mean, I didn't have, like, I wasn't friends with, like, the wrong crowd, but I very easily could have just, like, been one of those kids that didn't go to lessons, took up smoking.
I can't imagine you smoking, man. That'd be ridiculous.
I know, but I don't know what I'd end up doing. Like, well, I don't think it would be the same.
I've seen you smoke a cigar before, but I've never seen you. I can't imagine you with a pack of Lambert and Butlers around the back of the bike sheds with that, with the long sort of hair you used to have back in the day. Could have easily been an emo. Could have been confused for a goth kid.
Could well have been, yeah. But, you know, that's, and it's something that's so important. And for that opportunity not to be there, it doesn't have, I don't even think it has to be rugby, but, like, the fact is, a lot of schools don't even have a football team. They don't have a hockey team. They don't have, you know, a lot of these things. Or if they do, and it's like, they kind of, it's half-arsed. There's no, like, there's no pride in it. And it's the only reason I went to school was to go and play rugby for JCC. And that,
well, and do you remember how we made
so
it
much more?
Do you remember how we made it balance? We'd be like getting on a bus at like 9 a.m. with our school uniform on, because again, we were going to like private and public schools. It was like we have to show up wearing our blazers and ties and all that kind of stuff again. So we'd literally turn up like in our like, and the teacher would be saying about how long our tie was getting on the bus. We had to have like a proper looking tie, at least like a half Windsor kind of thing, didn't we? And you'd have to look presentable to go to.
Well, I remember as well, like the pride I felt in getting a first team tie as well to wear at school, and it was something different to everybody else. Like, no one else had a rugby tie.
Did you get yours in year 11? Because I think I got three or four, because we were, again, It was starting to drop off a little bit. There wasn't as many available quality players, I don't think, at that upper sixth level and stuff like that. So me and you were quite lucky in a sense. And again, this was kind of the luck of state school in some ways, I guess, because there wasn't like five teams all at one age group, is we got quite lucky to get a few senior caps in year 11. Yeah. It was like so 2 years below.
I don't think I got my first team.
Because you had to get 12, you had to play 12 first 15 games to get your tie. And I think I made two or three in that year.
Yeah, I made
one of which was literally 30 seconds off the bench. I remember that. We'd won the game, and Brooksy, the guy I was coaching at the time, brought me off the bench onto the wing for like 30 seconds, chased a kick. They put it out. That was the game over.
I played a few more because we were a little bit short on the, on quality front row. That short, they had to bring me in. I joke. I'm a legend of the front row.
He's a quality prop.
But yeah, like that meant so much to me, and that was something to really aspire to. And that was one of those things. Like, and I, like I said before as well, like, I was a very shy person, and I'm someone who does not hold myself in particularly high regard. Like, I never had a high opinion of myself growing up, for whatever many reasons. I guess I don't know. And like, that was something that really gave me a sense of pride in myself. I could very easily could have ended up doing like just completely going off the rails, and you know, because I didn't think much of myself. But that was like, I felt like it was something that made me, you know, I'd committed to something, I'd made something for myself to wear that. Think of the players who have also wore that tie, have earned that tie, and I've had to go through, you know, the exact same steps as them. And okay, we weren't maybe as successful a team, but we weren't terrible. You know, we got to
last 32 a couple of times in
we played Warwick School. I think the year they
won it,
the final, did they win it? And they only beat I think we were 8-5 up at half time.
When you came to Butt Lane, which is where the school is, you didn't have an easy day.
No,
first half, you won the toss, you got to play uphill with pick and go and carry hard at like 12, and that was it for the whole first half. Then the second half, we're kicking it to the corner downhill, looking for the driving ball opportunities, which back in my time in year 11, at least, or maybe lower sixth, I got a good 8 or 9 tries off the back of those mauls from the wing, joining at the last, ripping the ball from the hooker, falling over the line.
But we used to have some proper good ding dongs against some teams, and it was a level of rugby that you would not get on a Sunday playing club rugby, and it meant so much. And like I say, and we'll move on as well, get back to sort of a tour thing. But the big thing was the Canada tour at John Cleveland.
And it was biannual, wasn't it? Biannual tour.
Yes. And it's very sadly, I think we were the penultimate tour. I think one more went after us. And then I don't know how people have lost interest. I don't know why anyone would not want to go and do this. Like, you go 3 weeks just playing rugby and being invited to basically go boozing by like a lake or do something weird with some Canadian guys. And it's, you know, really good fun. You go in the summer, you get to do all kinds of good stuff.
It was topical because what we spoke about tonight and what's going on this summer, it was like, for us, like a bunch of state school kids, it was our Lions tour. It was a 21 or 22 day tour, I think. We played 8 games with a 36 man squad. And that was it. And that was our Lions experience. It was like, right, we're going to play. I know every game. I know exactly who we played. I remember the score. I know everything.
It's right. And like, it was like,
I remember every single thing that happened on that tour, and it had all sorts of bits to it. You know, it was just amazing. And then again, yeah, like you said, like for a bunch of guys who, you know what, outside of that, I think that was probably, and it's still probably the furthest I've been away from home. Like, you know, I've been to sort of Turkey and places like that, but I don't think I've ever been as far as there again.
Right, untraveled peasant. Oh, we'll get onto my further traveling later on because it is relevant. But I mean, that was a special tour. And obviously for like, I remember when we went, because how like the big fixture of the tour is to play the Ontario province team, which is kind of like a, I guess you could call it a Canada under 18s B, basically.
Yes, it's close. That most of those guys would have been picked for the age group, international maybe.
And like that was such a big deal. Like it was a really big game. I think
it was a big deal for us because again, that was the year where a lot of us played up in the senior team because the numbers had started falling out a little bit. So a lot of we got to go. Yeah, I was 15. Yeah. I was still 15 when we toured.
We were the young.
You'd only just turned 16.
Yeah, we were the youngest age group on the tour. Yeah. And because in theory, we could have gone twice, but like the interest wasn't there. But we said when we were 16, so I've not long been playing like in that first team. And I remember like that pride, that honour. And when I was told I was going to be starting for that province game, meant the world to me. That was like getting that Lions cap. It was, you know, and that's, you know, obviously it's not the same as like, or no one else is going to think of it or care anywhere near as much as somebody who's like on that Lions tour and they get given this test shirt. It's like, that's your test. But for me, that was the biggest thing I've ever achieved. Like, that meant so much to me. Like I said, not someone who has a lot of confidence in myself to get that meant so much. I remember the nerves before playing, thinking I can't let the team down.
Well, do you remember? So that for a lot of guys was their last ever game because it was always at the end of the school season. It was in July we went. It was July. So it was right at the end of school for a lot of guys. These were guys, you know, the guys who were in upper sixth for getting their A-level results and future was there. For us, it was like we just finished our GCSE. Everyone's going to pass them. Half people didn't even revise and they'll probably still get like Bs and As. You know, it's what it was. But like, yeah, that moment, I remember I got the shirt. I started on the wing, on the left wing. And that was one of the guys in upper sixth spot. I took his spot in the squad. I started the game and he didn't. And he cried. I remember he cried. And I felt horrible. But the mixture of emotion. And when you talk about these Lions things, people said, you know, you've got to keep back, you know, they've got to keep banging the drum for the guys who do get picked and you've got to push them hard in training that. And I felt like shit, you know, I've just took this guy's spot and I'm elated because I'm, like you say, buzzing to play the big game. But also I was gutted for my teammate, for my friend, right? And you have those moments. And at like 15, that was a really conflicting moment, which like I still look back on now like shit. Because I had an injured ankle and everything, but they strapped me up. And that was the first time I'd ever played injured. I'd never been hurt badly in a game, ever. And I've still got problems with that ankle now. You might hear it crack every now and then on the podcast. You hear it then, like, there you crack go. Then. That's it. I've got no ligament across my right ankle. It's snapped all to pieces and like frayed back together and healed all fucked up. And that's why it cracks, because it's like rubbing on itself. But you wanted to play. And that was I was like, there's no way I'm missing this game if I'm selected. I remember having that conversation with them in the hotel, like, are you fit to play? I was like, if you strap me up, I will play. I want to play. And we won that game and it was huge for us. It was immense.
We won the last minute kick as well. Remember. That was, God. I mean, that's, again, so, like, a wild thing. Another great thing, again, this is something with rugby as well. You're at school, you generally will associate with, like, your year, but there was 3 years, and when you're that age as well, like the difference between being 15 and 18 is huge. And but we all socialized together. There was times where because how those tours work, we would generally speaking, we'd stay with a host family, like one of the people you're playing against normally. And I remember sometimes I'd stay with guys who were older than us, and like I'd played with them a bit, but you know, you got to kind of know them a little bit better. And like these long bus journeys, we'd have like little activities, and you had to mix, and you kind of made proper friendships with people you wouldn't necessarily ordinarily have spoken to much. Because
and the guys you stayed with as well, the people who hosted you, I've still got email addresses and that of people who said, if you ever come back here and need a place to stay, you come and stay with us and stuff like that. And like, yeah, just again, just like, I know we keep banging on about this in this episode, but like state school people just didn't happen.
Yeah. And well, this is a weird thing.
We got to see so much stuff, man. We saw the Yankees play. I went to Montreal. You know, we got bikes in Montreal. The people I stayed with, and we cycled around Montreal. Me, Dylan, who's playing for the 99s, as well as Parin, sponsor of the podcast and team. And then Harry Whitehurst, who's perhaps could be considered in the future a doctor, Harry Whitehurst. He's doing mad stuff in the NHS. Like, we've all gone like these separate ways, but I know for a fact I can always ring those guys up and say, do you remember that time we were riding around bikes in the middle of Montreal and we went to Schlotz's Deli and got these like, you know, proper old school Jewish style smoked meat sandwiches with a mustard, and we saw Cirque du Soleil and stuff like that down at the harbour. You said it's great to share those stories with people.
And these are things that would not have happened to us. And I mean, this is kind of, I guess if you don't know us and you're not someone who's been on one of these tours, it's kind of just two blokes you don't know going down memory lane.
Have a similar story. Might be another John Cleveland somewhere up north or down south who had someone like a Dave Haybrook and co. to make this happen. And we packed bags to pay for the tour. We got donations from people. We packed bags at Morrison's. And like the more shifts you worked, the more you got off. And we had a tour match program, and you had to sell them like a fiver each, and that came off your cost of the tour. Because I remember some guys couldn't go, so they just couldn't afford it. That was where we came from. So then we were playing against people on the reg who were paying £9,000 nearly a turn.
Well, this is again an interesting thing. And you spoke about, we saw the Yankees play at that game. Just so happened that Leicester Grammar School were also there, and they used to tour every year somewhere. They'd been South Africa, they'd been, you know, wherever they'd go, and they would tour the time. And they were like, they would stay in hotels and stuff, and like we kind of bummed it. We were
staying in people's basements.
Yeah, I remember the first stop. I can't remember who it was who stayed there, but like the coach of the team we were playing basically had like six blokes in his house.
It was the coach's girlfriend's mum and dad. That's who we stayed with.
Like somebody slept on like an old, someone slept on a massage table or something.
Well, that might have been someone else might have done that. That might have been someone else with the coach's family.
Yeah, that was who stayed at the coach's house, had to sleep on a massage table.
But we stayed with his girlfriend's mum and dad.
Was it
Ross and Judy? I remember them.
Somebody, I think you two were playing in Montreal. Yeah, so Phil, this guy left everyone to go and see you two, and it was like they were like, no, this guy, the bloke was pissed up driving through the middle of Montreal. Obviously illegal, but like a weird story. But like those experiences you don't get like on a controlled school tour in a hotel. Like it was everyone's taste of what happened in Canada was slightly different. And
oh my god, yeah, it was. But then we had moments together as well. Like you might go to a house party and someone else's host was going to it as well.
Well, it was one of my favorite memories. We went to like a party by the lake, and I just remember, I have two memories. Is we had a boat race, and it was England versus Canada, and we all like linked up and sang the national anthem beforehand.
this isn't a story about a certain man who did something in the lake and then did something else. Was that you?
Thankfully, wasn't there for the story you're thinking of.
After
we did the national like boat race representing our countries, and then we all went skinny dipping. It was very fun to go and do, and like that's one of my favorite memories from that tour. It's just a real weird spontaneous thing, and like you wouldn't get them.
And as much as I'd love to stay on memory lane, I remember that tour, and you know, if anyone remembers it or whatever, shit, drop us a message and we'll reminisce, or we might even get someone on to do a guest spot to talk about some stories, because there's so many stories. We did court sessions. It just felt like the Lions, because I remember we'd got shown that 97 Lions tour documentary on the way to a tournament once or something like that, like years, like on one of another tours on a bus, and you sort of like, oh wow, this looks amazing, like look at the intensity of that. And it felt like that to us, because by that sort of age you knew you weren't like in the Tigers Academy sort of setup or on the books for county. You knew you weren't probably going to play professional, but you still had ambitions of maybe might get a chance of it. And then you realize by the time you're 17 18, it ain't gonna fucking happen, you're not nowhere near good enough, but you still have the ambition maybe at that stage. But that tour at that time was, yeah, the biggest thing, and still is probably one of the best things I've been involved in my whole life, for sure.
I mean, it's kind of a good point to move on as well, because I, but at that age, to be honest, okay, and I've maybe been hard on myself a bit. I was playing in that school first 15 for 3 years, which is no mean feat when you're 15 playing against 18-year-old blokes. But played that, you know, played for those years, and we weren't the most successful. I never considered myself, I guess, like a particularly good player. But then afterwards, you know, and moved on from the school, and I kind of had that confidence in myself and those experiences. I actually managed to then I started playing senior rugby. And it was a weird thing. I kind of ummed and ahed about stopping playing altogether. I wasn't sure who I wanted to play for. Because I didn't go to uni straight away. And I sort of like Hinckley Rugby Club, who I was playing, actually I was playing at OB Wings for Colts at the time. And like I played a couple of training sessions with their first team and didn't really like it. And I was like, I don't know. Didn't want to go and play in Hinckley because they were like national or on the cusp of National League, and thought it would be like, I don't know, I think training would be a bit tough as 18. So I decided to go to Rugby Lions. And because a friend of my, again, Phil again being mentioned, a friend of my, two of his friends were coaching Rugby Lions. They'd just been booted out the national leagues for not having any money, essentially. They completely had to restart. And so I went down Rugby Lions as a shy 18-year-old lad and kind of had to my first taste of men's rugby. And I remember, I guess it's another one of those moments of like really feeling like I'd earned something. And I remember working through pre-season, my first pre-season of a senior rugby. And I remember getting a call from the coach, Rob Walton, who I will go on to discuss in great deal shortly, to ring me up and say, look, Dav, you've got the starting shirt for the first game of the season. And I couldn't, like, that meant so much to me. It was like, I've earned this. And Rugby Lions, obviously, is a pretty big club. And that there was a real special air about this club that sort of died and started from the very bottom. And I, that first game on the road back in the league, and, you know, you look at that 15, it would be probably your own history of the club, but you know, my name's on it, and that was something special. But yeah, I went on to probably guess it start to achieve a bit more, but even still, looking back, that Canada tour is one of my fondest memories, and like that's an experience I won't ever get to have again. You know, it doesn't happen in men's rugby, it's such a special thing.
Well, I think it can happen. You've just got to have a club and a group of people who are in a position to do it, you know, and it would be amazing. But it can't ever happen again how it did, because it can't, because you're not 15, 16 thrown into the world of like under 19s rugby, and that's, it just can't happen again. You'll never have that kind of.
But even that, like, I think that 3 weeks tour, I just think you can't get as in outside of professional, but you're never going to get as a. As a senior,
it's difficult.
It's just, you're not even at the time. You wouldn't even probably get the time off work.
It's weird, man, to think about. You know, you get a bit emotional thinking about it, because, like, I think for a lot of the last 10 years, because it's 10 years in July since we went. It will be. I think I've been chasing that again, trying to feel something or have something the same as that in rugby. And like you say, it's just so difficult to find that. I think, you know, we got back from Canada, I started taking things really seriously, started lifting in the gym and stuff like that, and move position when we got back, because then we were sort of solid first 15 players and we were in lower sixth and established. And yeah, we got our, like I said, we got our ties and stuff like that. We were solid sort of members of that team. And, you know, you had the little bits and pieces and we went to things like sevens tournaments and stuff like that. And, but I was just always sort of chasing that experience again. And I think I have been ever since. And just, you know, I remember sort of bouncing in around Hinckley a little bit. I don't think I was ever going to be a first team player, I think a solid first team player anyway, but played a few sort of pre-season games, really fancied my chances and stuff like that. But then, you know, went off to uni and went my own way. So, and then just, yeah, I've never made, just because I went to uni, you change a little bit. Rugby changes a bit for you. I sort of did those 3 years at uni and you get that closeness again because you live with people, you spend a lot of time to this. It's different to what school was.
Mm.
And we had big games, had like the varsity fixtures, in which you have played in bigger varsity games than I have in terms of spectacle and stuff like that. But our games were, you know, that was the hardest game of the season. It was intensity and stuff like that. You know, if I had promotions, I got relegated from a books league while I was at that uni as well, because we'd gone up to quite a good one and played really well. We just, you know, came up short in too many games. But, you know, and you have those things and it was great. But then like uni tour is just, I never went on one. We were actually banned. If you're a member of the rugby club, you're banned for my first year. And then just after that, we were sort of like, nah, fuck it, I don't want to go. And it was just a very different experience. And I really, really enjoyed university rugby. I've got friends for life, some of which you are going to represent in the 99s as well. But again, you get these friendships that stay forever. And you play with these people and stuff like that. It's amazing to have. And I can't wait for that. But just, you know, I was always just chasing that tour. And I think realizing now, I really just sat here. It's not depressed. It's not depressed. It's not struggling. But there's a bit of an emptiness in my life to a degree.
It's very deep. I perfectly understand what you mean, because it's that thing that's the past, isn't it? And it's you know you're very, very unlikely to make it unhappen. I guess that's something we're attempting here with us at the 99s.
To give people that kind of sort of same feeling,
create that thing. I think, you know, ideally these sevens weekends, these camping experiences, hopefully these summers can go some way to rival that. I mean, I think about the experiences that I've had. So I spoke a second ago at my first sort of dipping the toes in at senior rugby, and when I went down to Rugby Lions, and it was, like I said, nearly stopped playing because I kind of didn't know where to go and play. And so the Rugby Lions of that team, we had a really kind of special like team going on, and that's kind of like, in a strange way, because we're playing the bottom of the barrel, like Midlands Five, which is not a high level of rugby by any stretch, but it very nearly springboarded me into touching, like, with literally getting within touching distance of possibly like the professional game, because I say started there and we had a really good first season. We won every game in the league. We scored like 1,000 points in like a 10-team league. We won every tournament we played in, except for one particularly special one, where we got to go and play at Twickenham, the national Vars, the junior Vars, as it's called. It's like the lowest cup final you play at Twickenham.
So is it level eight?
Level nine and ten.
Jesus.
And I remember
that's special though, isn't it?
And this was something. I remember these cup games. I think I spoke about this possibly before this cup run, and think of how big these games were. And we say we had like 1,000 people at this semi-final, and we played. And I remember we won that game, and we got to go and play at Twickenham. And everything about that, we went down the day before. We went to watch Wasps, I think, on the Saturday, because the game was on Sunday morning. We got a pep talk from James Haskell, because one of our players happened to know him. He was our captain, actually. And it was so weird. I remember we had like a training session on like a golf course, which I'm fairly sure we just broke onto and had like a little like run through of things. Had like stayed in a hotel, had like a dinner, had like a shirt presentation. It was really special. And that was one of those things where to get that shirt on presented to you, and like, yeah, this is playing at Twickenham. Obviously, you know, that experience is something that so few people get to go and do. And we actually lost the game. One of the very, very few games of rugby I've cried after. And I think it was like exhaustion, like physically and emotionally. I'm just, we lost the game, and I remember it was one of those games where you were really in the game, but it just sort of slipped away from you, like just slowly. And like we didn't play as well as we had done all year. I just remember feeling like I'd given my all and it wasn't enough, and I felt like I'd let the team down. I remember walking up the steps, the Twickenham steps, to get my runners-up medal, and we're walking back down again, and like feeling a bit glum. And I remember someone just said to me, like, "Oh, Dav, you okay?" And said those horrible words, and just like, "No," like broke down to like cry. And that was again another sort of moment with me again, and Rob and Walton. Again, it was a very special for me because Rob Walton again, he was the coach. Sort of a family friend who kind of like was took me under his wing, I guess, when I was there. And he had a decent career, played in the Perth Hemp Bees, Birmingham Solihull team that beat Wasps. He played for Rotherham, he played, you know, National League rugby for a long time. And he kind of like consoled me after losing the game and like told me he was proud of me, and that was meant so much. And him is, I say, I talk about my mum and my brother being like the key things, but in terms of certainly senior rugby, without a shadow of a doubt, like Rob Walton was the man that made what happened, everything that's happened for me since happened. He's the kind of guy, the first time I really felt like he was someone who really let me know, he's like, "You are a good player," really made me believe in myself, and it meant so much. And I had two great years playing under him. Very tragically died in an accident, very unexpectedly to us all on holiday. And that was, it kind of put a stop to my, like, I guess my development in a lot of ways as a young rugby player. Because I went to Australia after this, I flew to Australia literally like the next week and played a season out there, came back, played three seasons back to back, like English, Australian, back to English again. And we had another really good season. I then got picked to play Warwickshire, got picked to play the Midlands under 20s. And that was like, we had this weekend away at Welbeck College. And it was like, it was a trial for England counties under 20s. So we got a chance to maybe represent my country, admittedly, like at an amateur level. And it was, everything was going really, really well for me. And then, say that August, I think it was, when Rob Walton died, or Yogurt as we know to him, it kind of, I fell out of love with the game because this guy who meant so much to me had, and he touched so many people in like the rugby circle. And I think his funeral was testament to that, because it's like there basically wasn't a church big enough in Leicestershire to host the funeral. Like, I had to go to there's a Catholic church in England, it's huge, and it was packed to the rafters for his funeral. And like everybody had the same kind of stories. He's just a guy who really loved rugby and like such a nice bloke. And he's about 6'10". He was a giant. He had this big, ridiculous grin. And like, it was so weird after, like, the people you meet in rugby, and like without, again, I say about what I dread to think where I would have been without going to JC for school, but I dread to think where I would be without him, coming and and sort of doing what he did for me and making me feel so proud of myself. And yeah, that, you know, I owe so much, literally everything I think I have now, rugby or otherwise, I probably in a lot of ways owe to him. And you know, it's almost unbelievable. I think it's been nearly 6 years, I think, since his tragic passing. But
yeah.
You know, whenever I drive through Desford, and I always say hello to him, I know that's where his grave is. But you know, I wouldn't have met him through rugby, and everything I've got since, you know, going to Australia was something I got to do because of him, playing at Twickenham, and I got to do because of him, taking rugby really seriously and sort of seeing myself as a good player is because of him. The 99s wouldn't be happening without him. You know, I wouldn't have gone to uni. I wouldn't have succeeded at uni because of him. Everything's happened since. And that's what makes, you know, certainly my experience with rugby special, is meeting people, you know, like that. And I think a lot of people have got experience with coaches who aren't, you know, they aren't family members. They aren't somebody or someone you necessarily would have come into contact with, but because of rugby, you know, your life changed for the better in unbelievable ways, in every way, really.
Yeah, you know, it's, I think everyone's, you know, or at least a lot of people have got a yoga in their rugby story, or maybe any sport, maybe, you know, they're a runner or a football player or boxer, wrestler, they've got those people in their story, and it's great. And, you know, we've got a lot and of those people, and those are the people that are as important as the game itself, because like we always say, without, you know, without fans, without spectators, without supporters, without people to make these things happen, they don't happen, you know. And I think it's nice for us to hopefully be our own yogurt, you know,
yeah,
what we're doing, maybe, I mean, for someone, you know, if it benefits one person mentally, emotionally and success wise then it's worth it, isn't it? And I think maybe that's what it's all about, and that's what I love about coaching myself, is to hopefully help people go that bit further on, and wherever it might be, or just achieve something that they want to achieve, and or maybe for a town, you know, to do something like what you guys had. And I know the club here had that success for itself in the recent years of actually winning the intermediate, I think it was, or junior vars, one of, off the top of my head, I don't exactly remember the name of it, but they went to Twickenham, they won the final. So they've had that day and they've had that success. And I think, you know, it's something that shut the whole town down, because everyone gets on buses and makes that journey to West London. So, and that's something that we're committed to wanting to do again, and something that I really want to be a part of. Because like I say, I think maybe part of why I'm being a coach is because I'm chasing those days again, like we had as young people, but in a slightly different arena.
Yeah.
Because it's what you want to be part of it. And like you said, there's certain people who help you be part of it and make you want to be part of stuff. So I guess maybe to be someone who's like that for people is something that's maybe what's interesting about this whole coaching thing. And to yeah, I'm just chasing having a big, those yeah. big days again. And you want to deliver them. But I think our journeys were slightly different there. Because I remember you going to, you didn't go to uni straight away and you went to Australia, yeah, within sort of like a year or so of us finishing our A-levels and that. Whereas I went straight to uni. I literally, because my birthday is in August, it's always like really late. So I'd literally turned 18 and 2 weeks later, I'd moved out from home and I've never been back since, except for a couple of months last year before I moved down here, which was strange for me. It was the first time I'd lived at home in 7 years nearly.
Yeah. It's weird. So, I mean, we didn't fall out of touch, but we went from seeing each other every day to like,
it's strange,
speak really to occasionally. Yeah, I think uni rugby, I think probably say you've had different experiences. And uni rugby for me is a funny one. The potential for it is so huge, but certainly I think like at the universities we went to, it's, I guess, a kind of a bit of a missed opportunity.
Those growth universities for sure, it's not quite getting there. I remember, like, again, it was kind of like how it was at school for us. It was exactly the same thing. I was a little bit at times like frustrated in the pit of my stomach, because I was like, fuck, we're throwing it away again.
Yeah,
that's what I always felt about school. I felt we threw away a really good chance to maybe be better than we were. Like, we've spoke about this before, but I sort of felt, yeah, the same thing kind of happened at uni to a degree, because we're first year we were playing sort of, think, what was Midlands One. The league's been restructured before, so not far off like the national setup, and we got relegated. It was a 14 game season, so if you don't win games, you get relegated. It's tight. It's not like Saturday rugby, we have like 20 odd games, you can lose 10 and still do all right. You lost 5-10 games, that's it, you're done. So we got relegated that year. You know, we won like 3 or 4 games, lost 10, and that was it, though. Not enough bonus points or whatever, and down we went. And then, yeah, but it never felt, you know, like you say, the facilities are there and stuff like that, but it never felt serious enough. We didn't do like morning gym sessions. I thought it was going to be like being a pro athlete, but it's not. Exeter it is, maybe, or Durham or wherever they have that kind of, you know, where you're a performance athlete. But again, I probably was never really good enough player to play at those levels. But then you find yourself almost being like a sport development officer with like the committee. I got on the committee and I was the events secretary for 2 years, and we threw big events. We had like a bar crawl that had 900 people on it or whatever, like these huge numbers. And it's still not this year, obviously, but it still probably would do well if it had, you know, the scape to go ahead. In a different universe, it probably is happening. But we had those morning sessions. I remember my last year, we were trying to get back to that league that we'd been in, and we'd missed out the year before. We lost 2 games, because it's brutal. You only have a 10 game season after they restructured the leagues and stuff like that. So my third and final year, here we go. I'd never won a varsity game. We'd lost both the varsity games in my 2 years to date. And then it was us versus the University of Birmingham, like second or third team. So they showed the scope. We were like a first team, yeah, playing these guys to win a league. and it was winner take all game. And yeah, we lost by, it was 20 points to 14. We lost by like a try, you know, it was dreadful. The worst, that's the worst feeling I've ever had after a game. I'd never lost a game that big because we were always, we were at school, we were expected to lose cup games. So you kind of took it hard, but not that hard because you were always playing schools who had a lot more than you did. But this felt a game we really could win. And we've worked so hard in the gym and stuff and it didn't work out. And I'm not afraid to say I cried after that one because that was our moment. And that was the biggest game for me at that point in my life. Like I say, you, if you don't make the cut, you are to be top level. These games become your Premiership final. They become your, you know, Heineken Cup final. They become your World Cup. That's what they become for you. So, yeah, I was gutted, man. I was so heartbroken. We had a bus full of people come with us, which was weird. We'd never had that. We had like 60, 70 odd people come and watch on the buses with us. We had a bus full of people. It was amazing. But yeah, and you lose out that kind of game and then that's it. You're done. Your 3 years are done. If you pass your degree, you're done and you're away. But the great thing about uni again is it touches so many people because I think when we left, we'd grown it from barely scraping a team in my first year. So we had three full teams. And it felt like, wow, we'd built something really good. And it's doing well now. The guys have done well. And I went on to coach them. I coached there for 4 years, 2 years as like assistant, 2 years as like the sort of head coach. And here I am now. So again, I wouldn't be sat where I am now without that experience at uni. So, you know, that uni was kind of like my guiding thing, giving me that platform. So,
yeah, I think what's really good about uni rugby is it gives people that kind of opportunity to be a proper leader.
Mm.
I mean, like, because when I went to uni rugby, like, I was lucky enough because of the experiences I'd had playing for Midlands, playing in Australia, I think, which I haven't kind of brushed over, but, you know, playing pretty high level. I was playing for, when I was at Rugby Lions, yeah, we got promoted from mid five all the way up to mid two, and we won that league. Like, you know, we were a really good team. And I played, I had that experience. I was looking to get a scholarship that got paid money to come play for the uni rugby team. But my first year, it was kind of, we had maybe the reverse effect. The first year, we had a really good team, really well committed. It's that thing where rugby kind of, university rugby is missed potential. Because we had, in terms of playing staff, a better team the rest of my time we were there. But the commitment was just lacking. And it was, you know, lads would rather go out and have a beer than train. And we did have like those morning sessions, those S&C sessions that were, you know, if nothing else, even if you didn't get necessarily the physical benefit from going to them, the like commitment, the team bonding of that, you're all getting up at 6 a.m. to turn up and, you know, flog yourself to then go and, you know, and train. And it was really annoying. We could have, so our big varsity game, we get to De Montfort University, we're like the underdogs, we get to go and play Leicester Union, we play it at Welford Road. There's normally like a few thousand people there, like the Crumbie Terrace is normally pretty much full. There's a good atmosphere and it's like you're playing in front of so many people. We used to be playing at Welford Road and it was our first year. We lost in literally the last play of the game. I'm going to call it out here as well. The referee played about 8 minutes of added time. You can go and watch it on YouTube, search, I think it's 2017 varsity, Leicester varsity. And it's like 89 minutes on the clock when they score. And then miraculously it's full time at the end of the game after that. And that, never mind the fact that, and it wasn't like ball was in play that time. There's about 17 knock-ons after 80 minutes, but the ref kept playing. Still not over it. But like that was amazing. We got that because Leicester Uni hadn't lost a game at all for like 2 years.
I remember I played them in my first year. We played their first, like it was versus them in my first year at Uni. They were always a really solid side. Yeah, I think, and I think I actually played against our former captain, sorry, when we were in, we went on that Canada tour.
Yeah.
Well, our captain that season had been a Dan Hughes, who affectionately renamed me Don because he said no one else could be called Dan in the senior setup. I was like, okay, terrified of this upper six guy. He's like, you're Don from that one. So the whole year being Don or Donald.
I remember that. I completely forgot.
I played it. But when I got to uni, because obviously he was always 2 years above us, he was in his third year of university at Leicester. And I played against him, which was just crazy because we played together, you know. But this is the great thing about rugby. It doesn't stop moving forward. It still lives and breathes. And, you know, I remember at uni playing old boys games. And I've been back as an old boy now and played these games because they're great days as well. We used to get like 80 lads together, like two squads of like 30 odd players and a few people who can't be fucked to play. They're just there for the beers or they're injured or whatever. And literally have like play like a half, and then 15 new guys would come on and just play each other, and you'd be getting boozed on the sideline, and then you all go out and, you know, do some crazy stuff and you meet people. I met someone from Hinckley who'd gone to the uni like 10 years before I got there, and we're Facebook friends now, and sort of you see what he does every now and then. We don't talk or anything, but you know, you're connected to these people.
Yeah,
we're from the same town, but I had no idea who he was. We never met, and it just happened, went to the same uni and that. So it was those great things, but I kind of felt it was the same as, yeah, I don't know whether you felt the same. It was kind of like the Cleves again, in a way. We kind of always were like a bit of an underdog uni. We weren't like a great uni at the time. It's a growing uni derby and stuff like that. So, yeah.
It felt like it was a real special thing. And De Montfort University had gone from really not giving much of a hoot about sport to sort of really trying to push it. And we always, I think every single uni sports team has this thing where they fall out with the sports office, the people in charge, every single university seems to be miraculously incompetent. And so like all that, being on that committee for me, I was named captain. I was first team captain in my second year and then club captain in my final year. Although I was injured for most of that, so I didn't actually play. It's kind of, I'm still sort of on the comeback trail from that injury. It was like 3 years ago now. 2 years ago. I think. No, it must be 3 years ago. November 2018 it was. But that position that it gives you, that to really kind of find out who you are, I think you've got to be in that position of leadership. I say we had that real potential from my first year. We kind of squandered, I guess. In many ways, I could take the blame for us. As captain,
you should
be one of the people in the committee, but like we tried everything, and for whatever reason, like guys just didn't want to commit to it. And I don't know if that's I know people always say, oh, the youth of today. I don't know if it's just the way it, like there is that gap of kind of our kind of generation, because I was a couple of years older than even the guys in my year, so I was, you know, a good nearly 5 years older than people who were the freshers when I was, you know, leaving. And there was definitely, you could tell the difference, and they were very immature in a lot of ways. And then maybe that's something that's...
Well, it's strange, isn't it? We were always immature, but we were always committed. I just don't... Yeah, I struggle to see a lot now, but I just see it in some people. We've got some guys here at the club who are sort of 19, 18, 19, 20, and they're just madly committed. They work hard and stuff like that. They're at every session. So it's like... Yeah, it's just strange though. At uni, for some reason, it just doesn't seem right all the time. And I've seen it over the years coaching. Like, I'd go to a coaching session and like got 60 odd registered players, but I'd do a session for like 13 guys.
Yeah, I think
where the. But when I was there, we always had 20, 30 guys at training. It just dropped a little bit.
I mean, this is weird things. I've never one of those people who had that mentality. Like, oh, I'm not going to bother tonight. Like, I would. If I absolutely couldn't be there, so be it. But that happened about three times the entire time I've been playing rugby. Like, I never just missed a session because I couldn't be asked. I don't understand. It's not a mentality I understand, but I never got it. Like, uni especially, I get it when you're, you know, if you're 19 and you're playing club rugby and you're like second team rugby or whatever, I understand that. Like, you know, but university rugby is kind of special. You've just got all that time. You can literally dedicate your life to it.
The closest you are to being a professional, if you've never been close to being a professional, literally.
It's a weird thing. It's kind of like a chicken egg situation, I think, where the universities want to see commitment from, you know, teams before they sort of throw them a bone. But at the same time, like, you need to give a bit to get a bit. And we felt like we just got disregarded for every other club at the university. So, like, it was, even though, and to be fair, in my first season at DMU, we won the Midlands Cup. And we were the first DMU team in any sport in the history of the university to win a trophy.
Yeah.
And, well, And again, the only reward we got from it was Leicester City's Christian Fuchs bought us dinner. But the university itself, they didn't reward the team. It's not like this, they didn't give us like, oh, well, this team's got potential. This team could move on. Because we had like a good, strong bunch of first-year players in the team, like myself included. We had a guy who went on to play for Wasps briefly in that team. Like, they didn't go, okay, well, let's maybe give this team a bit more time and money. Like, they... Again, and I get why they want as many people playing as possible, but it's like they kind of let it get fall by the wayside, and they would be in contention with us more than like helping us out.
The issue I see a lot,
kind of killed it in the end.
Yeah, the issue I see a lot with the universities is it's participate over performance a lot of the time,
but they,
and it costs money at the end of the day. It costs money, and they have to fund themselves, because what you tend to get is you get like the university, and then the funding goes to the sport, and it's its own basic business almost. It's got like a hierarchy in it, and then they've got to generate income to, and you always get like two or three performance sports, they call it a lot of the time.
Yeah,
but if you want sports to be good, amateur sport costs money.
Yeah, but my argument with them always was, we're kind of off topic, I think we kind of got to the end of this episode really now, and I think university rugby is probably another potential topic in itself, but my argument was always that there are like probably three sports that matter at uni, just rugby union, football, probably hockey. They're the three sports that really mean anything. Like, they're competitive at every university, more or less. I guess you could argue netball.
Netball. Netball's the same as football in terms of just sheer numbers that play it. It's like one of the biggest sports in the country. Plus, there is a decent netball super league now, so there is a professional pathway, which is what Book Super Rugby is great for. Again, another episode, but that's what Book Super Rugby was always great for.
So my argument always was that those are the sports you have to get good, and the rest will follow. Like, you're not going to build a university sports section by having, you know, by giving korfball and like volleyball and lacrosse equal footing to these other clubs that get, you know, twice as many members. Do you think, like, obviously rugby, you've got a match day squad is like 20 odd players. If you get two or three teams, that's 60 players. Whereas something like, I don't know, basketball is five players on a team. Like, you can get hundreds of teams out in theory of basketball, but they treat like the basketball third team the same as they would like the rugby like second team or first team. It's not really the same.
It was always difficult for us because it's like you said, it was kind of like, if you want to get the funding, you've got to be playing at a certain level, but to help us get to the certain level, we needed this support, and people are reluctant to spend their money, then politics comes into it, and then for us when I was coaching as well, it was the guys had an attitude of fuck you, we're not working with you. So then, like, when I first got in as the head coach, I had to like basically be kind of like a DOR in terms of building this whole off-field package. But then you don't always get the commitment to that. And it's just, it creates this whole swirling sort of nightmarish kind of situation where you're trying to get commitment from people and that. But, you know, that ended well for me. I mean, that's kind of the end of my story up to now would be, I finished at uni and I got my level two that summer, and I was like, what am I going to do? Because I kind of floated through my undergrad. I didn't know that I wanted to work in sports still, even though I now had a degree in it. So I ended up coaching, which is invoiced at like £10 or £15 an hour, I think it was at the time, for like 6 hours a week. And then I worked for the YMCA. I was a PE teacher with no teaching qualification for like four to six months in a primary school. And I went to Scandinavia for like 6 weeks on a little bit of a hot traveling and all that kind of stuff. So I hadn't done that. And then I came back and got a job working at the university so I could keep coaching. Like, worked in like the career service, which I now work in as a career now. So it all just, it's weird how these things work. But when I got back, I was looking for the coach of a guy who played at Nottingham, Newport Gwent Dragons. But also, you know, he was also the coach at Ilkeston Rugby Club. So I went and played a season for them. And that was maybe kind of the beginning of the end for me being a player. We went on a 1-25 slide at Midlands One. And it was the worst year of rugby in my life. I've never lost. We played these private schools and that. We never lost, got hammered really rarely by more than 30 odd points. I lost four or five games by 80, 90 points. It was horrendous.
Just, yeah.
killed me for a year. And I was like, damn, I don't know if I want to play anymore. I'd lost it because I didn't have the love that I had when I was playing with like you guys or at the uni and stuff like that. And then I went to Derby because that's where a lot of my mates play. Rondell, friend of the pod, through the Yarder Collective, and a couple of guys who were going to play for the 99s, still play for them now, and I played with them there. So I went there and just, yeah, really struggled to ever get a consistent run in the first team. You know, maybe not quite good enough. Maybe there were better players in those positions that I played at the time. A few people said I should move to hooker from centre, and it's still something that a lot of people had said since. So maybe I made a bit of a mistake there, dropped the ball a little bit. Might have been better there, but yeah, just never really got in. And then, you know, ruptured the old bicep. I was out for a whole year at one point back in 2018. So I just turned 23, ruptured my bicep the week before my birthday in a preseason game when I was arguably had my name on the 12 or 13 shirt because I'd literally just scored a 60 metre worldie of a try. 5 minutes later, ruptured my bicep trying to like drift tackle someone. And then, yeah, so I lost a year there and then really fell in love with coaching because I focused all my energy on coaching and developing as a coach whilst doing my rehab, talking to people, learning from people, spending time at Nottingham Rugby Club, you know, a few things like that. And then, yeah, we got to like last year, COVID sort of killed the season. The uni, we got promoted finally after 4 years of trying and we won our first varsity fixture along that journey as well for like 4 years. And I just realised I didn't love playing anymore. I'd give up a little bit. And I enjoyed it in patches. Much like a team where you say they look really good in patches, then for like 60 minutes of the game, they look half-assed. That's kind of how I felt. But I still turn up to training all the time. I still give it all, enjoyed the socials, made friends for life and stuff like that. You know, but I'd fell out of love with it, mate. I think I was just chasing that feeling. I wasn't getting that feeling anymore that I'd had in that game when I cried because we lost, because it meant so much to me. And when we went on tour in those games for Cleveland, it just didn't mean as much to me anymore. I'd lost the kind of love for it and I'd fell in love more with coaching. And that's what led me to go, do you know what? I'm not going to play anymore. Played my last ever game at scrum half, which might be funny to you. Had a quite a good game. Played in a cup final at scrum half. And that was
who it. Who for?
Derby. All the scrum halves were injured. I was the only person who could possibly play there.
God. literally was nobody else. Everyone else who was fit was already in the team.
All I'm saying, Dav, is we won the game.
Or the dodgy 39-year-old loose head replacement who doesn't train.
The service was all right, mate. The service wasn't bad. Service off the deck was good, but every line out, I got them to bring it to the floor and pop it to me. I wasn't having anything off the top. Did not want any of that. I was like, you got to bring that shit down.
Your box kick.
Didn't need to, actually. Didn't need to at any point.
I would have done it for the sake of it if I was at nine. I'd have done it 5 meters out. It's gone, fuck it, put one up, get under it. Wait to hear the coach just die on the sideline.
Anyway, we got through that game unscathed and we had a pretty good win. And that was kind of a nice way to finish playing 15 aside, I think. I think that is it. I don't think I will play again. So just to finish off my story chronologically, because I know we don't want to go on forever and ever. We might have to pay for extra monies on the podcast hosting service at this rate. But it's been really nice, actually. This is a bit of realization for me in this episode and a bit of like
it's been kind of
mental health. Quite nice, yeah. Bit nice, but yeah, so the story up to now, I guess, yeah, to finish off the timeline, I guess you can round yours off as well. Is yeah, so last year, obviously, COVID hit, the season finished for the uni, we'd achieved all our goals, and I was like, right, on to the next thing. I want this to be my career now, I want this to be what I do long term, coach sport. You know, I've worked with a few different athletes across different sports, and I just want to work in sport. That's all I wanted to do. I'd got my master's because I decided I wanted to do it properly. And I came across the job here, the head coach job at Honiton. I applied for loads, private schools, public schools, clubs up and down the country that were advertising through various agencies or online, whatever. I found this one at Honiton Rugby Club as the head coach. They'd said about the junior vars or whichever one it is, all this kind of stuff. And we're looking to, you know, maintain this or get to the next step. But we've had a change of circumstance. Our current coach has had to leave because of all that's happened. Send your CV and stuff like that. And I didn't hear anything for a few weeks, and I'd heard back from some other ones. I'd gotten an offer pretty much from one up in Scotland, and I was kind of getting close to another role as a coach. And then these guys got back to me, had a few video calls much like this and chatted away about what I thought I could do for the club and stuff, and then came down for a visit in August, and the rest is history. I sit here now as the head coach of the club there, and enjoying it. Minus all the shit we've been through over the last year, but
yeah,
overall enjoying it. Love the people, love living down here. It's very different. I spent my entire life in the Midlands. Leicester, then Leicestershire, then Derby. It's nice to be closer than 2 hours to the sea.
Yes.
And I see, and now, and again, here I am again, chasing the dragon a little bit in terms of I'm looking for that feeling again, giving it all I've got, really. And it's difficult. I'm getting a bit emotional about this whole thing. I think we both have, and it's kind of this realization. That's what I've been doing for the last 10 years, is trying to get back to that feeling. And I've had it a few times. I've been close to it. I had it at uni with the guys. It mattered that much to me. And I wanted it for a little while, playing club rugby, and it just didn't quite get close to it anymore. I didn't enjoy it anymore. And coaching the uni boys is where I felt it the most. And that's probably why I'm doing the coaching. That's why I want to do it. And that's why I see it as my big day, to maybe coach someone like the Lions or something like that. That's the dream anyway. And it is quite sad, really, that I've been spending this last sort of 10 years nearly just going after that, feeling that way again. And it's quite apt that it is 10 years to the day of things like that tour to Red Roof and stuff. I've been, wanting to feel that way again, really, man. And it's a really eye-opening conversation this has been. And I don't think you can underestimate this kind of thing. I'm getting a bit choked up. I really am. Because it's not sad, but it feels like it is a little bit, in a way, because I sort of think like, do I have anything else other than this game?
Yeah.
I kind of feel like that a bit. I feel like that a little bit. I feel sometimes like, what else is there to me than this game? And is that why we're doing this thing with the Sevens a little bit?
I think, just to give my kind of, let's say, recent last couple of years, because I got injured 2018, playing in a university second team game, which was punishment because I
never play twos if you don't have to.
I was club captain, first team captain, got red carded. Daniel, you know this story very well.
The people don't know it.
The people don't know the story. It's not my proudest moment, obviously.
Just give us the cliff notes.
I'll set the scene. It was a place was always an unhappy hunting ground in my time at Devonthe University. Played University of Nottingham, second team, away. And we'd always struggled against them. I think we lost every time I played against them, and we played them every year. And we beat them once in a cup game. I was captain, met the ref before the game, as you do. He was a bit off with me. I don't know why. I was very, polite, welcoming, spoke to him as you would. Didn't do anything rub up the wrong way. Maybe had a vendetta against it from the start. I don't know. Anyway, throughout the course of the game, he made about three blunders that led directly to tries for the other team. I can't remember exactly what they were. One was a forward pass. One was several offences, including offsides and knock-ons. And he didn't give any of them, and they scored a proper bundle try. And I said, "Like, how could you possibly award that?" Which wasn't the best way to approach it, but it was that bad a decision anyway. And later on in the game, the straw that broke the camel's back, we had our own line out about halfway. We won the line out. We threw it in. Our second row caught it. The opposition player went to grab the ball, grabbed the guy's arm and tugged him down. So he sort of came down sideways. I was the back lifter. And he came down sideways and we did our best to sort of bring him down to the ground. But he was, say, coming down that way. The ref gave a penalty against us, saying, "You've not brought the man down safely." I said, "What? Excuse me? You haven't brought the man down safely. It's a penalty." And I said, "He's pulled him down. Like, very clearly he's pulled him down." "No, full-on penalty." "That's not a rule." And so he said, "No, get back 10 metres. Okay. Under my breath, jogging off, I went, "You're a fucking joke, man." Because he was piss poor. And he said, "I won't be called a joke." I didn't even look. I knew it was red. And I just walked up and said, "Learn the fucking rules then, you twat."
Oh, mercy. That is very undercutting.
Out of character, I think you'll admit.
Yeah, very, very out of character. Every now and then, people I've coached may say, "You will see the red mist of me come down again." And I have shouted at referees before. It is very frustrating. Okay. Uni refs aren't great.
He was a young lad. He was probably about 19, 20. And he had the air. I fully maintain, as much as I was in the wrong, and I shouldn't have said it, and I appreciate that I was, you know, did not handle that situation at all well. But he was an arsehole. He deserved a lot worse than being called a fucking joke under his breath. Like, it was one of them refereeing performances where he could have got beaten up after the game and wouldn't have been out of order.
Had it been in a rougher part of the UK?
Yeah, like I've heard stories of refs being thrown in canals, that sort of thing.
So you get sent off the only time it's ever happened. He's a good boy, really. Don't you know, Mary? He's a good boy.
I charmed him at the disciplinary thing. Don't you worry. You've got a minimum 3 weeks.
So
the maximum for abuse of a match official is quite strong.
Is it?
Yeah.
Just ask Dylan Hartley.
I've only ever had before that one yellow card, which wasn't even my fault. Somehow mistaken identity. I've had two yellow cards in my career, both for mistaken identity, both for the same bloke who looks nothing like me. both for side entry in a mall as well. Anyway.
We won't go into my disciplinary record. It's not quite as... It's a bit more colourful.
Patchy at best.
Yeah.
Not many reds, though, if any.
I've never been given a red card, no.
No, just a lot of yellows.
A lot of yellows. Quite a few.
Most of them for fighting. Anyway, as punishment for this game, I played in a university second team game. We won by about 100 points. I spent the entirety of the game more or less coaching on the pitch and just giving people the ball into space to run for a hole. The one time I got sort of took the ball into contact, I fell down with my arm outstretched basically and somehow managed to impinge my shoulder. And it was fucked, to use a technical term, for about 6 months. I couldn't lift my arm above like horizontal or like up at all. It's like there was a block in my arm. It couldn't move. Like physios couldn't push it up. And since then, I sort of haven't really ever recovered to play. I kind of wasn't really fit enough to be playing, and sort of came back would have been the season before this one, the one that got COVID affected. I played the first two games, then I fell ill with a mystery illness, and then I haven't been back, basically. I started doing a bit of fitness work to get back to playing. This is sort of about November, December time. I kind of was going to get back to rugby and then basically couldn't afford it because I've just graduated from uni, couldn't afford subs. So I sort of couldn't afford the gym either, actually. So I couldn't really couldn't repair my shoulder enough to kind of come back. I didn't want to come back and like play second team rugby or whatever and then get hurt again. So I was kind of biding my time to get fit again. And then obviously COVID happened. The 2019-20 season is best summed up by one of the players at OB Wigs who said, "Constant rain and an apocalypse. This is the worst season ever."
Well, I was playing at Derby, so I say that last game was like the week or so before the first lockdown, first lockdown as it's known, which over a year ago now. But literally, we didn't play a game for like 5 weeks before that because the club was underwater. People might have seen this if they are aware of Derby Rugby Club or have seen it possibly on some of the rugby meme pages because it was memed quite a lot. The club was literally underwater for weeks. It just kept flooding and flooding and flooding. We had an artificial pitch just put in.
It's all weather, isn't it?
Which I never understood why they did that. It's on a floodplain. The club is on a floodplain, but it was this whole thing about putting it in the local area. It'll bring clubs in and all that. I was like, okay, you know, whatever. None of us liked it. The amount of burns I've got and stuff like that is ridiculous from that pitch. Scars to this day. But yeah, it was underwater, so I didn't play. Yeah, like you, I didn't play for like 5-6 weeks from January last year. And then we played one game in March. That was it. Done. Won a trophy. Got the shield as captain as well that day. Not just scrum half, but captain. Got to raise the shield. The old NLD reserve team cup or whatever it was. Or trophy
or
whatever.
That's the real deal. That's what the big teams care about.
Well, Dave, like I said, I've had my sad moments, but that was the one that I won. That one didn't get away.
You stole the trophy. It's on your wall. I can see it behind you now.
Well, it was, to be fair, because obviously we went into lockdown, so I was still living with some friends and the guys in Derby, one of which, shout out to Patrick Burke, will be featuring for the 99s. Yeah, it was on our mantle for a little while in the house, and we pride of place because me and him both played in that game. And we're like, yeah, that's all right, bit of all right. And then when I moved back to Leicestershire before coming down to Honiton, and it was, yeah, I had to drop it by the club. But it was a weird year, man. It's been a weird year since, and I'm just so excited for us to get this thing out there.
What feels so strange as well is I feel like I've spent time away from the game, but I'm not. The game just hasn't been there.
Yeah, it's not.
End of September, October 2019, the last time I played, then was ill for about a month into December time. Then, again, sort of couldn't really afford to play, and then there just hasn't been rugby to go and play, like in Leicestershire anyway. I know some clubs around the country played a couple of friendlies now, but nobody's played for so long. Kind of worried to think where rugby will go. It's probably an episode in itself, a return to play episode.
Well, it's something for the listener to think about, I guess. Yeah. Where do you see it going? I mean, yeah, it's look, we need, but who knows? I mean, they're just talking about this new variant and stuff like that. I don't know. It's so selfish to have the point of view that a lot of us have who are around our age, but I'm not scared of this thing. If it's what takes me, it's what takes me. You know, I don't want to live my life indoors. You know, you're only 25 to 30 once.
Yeah.
You don't want to lose those years, you know. And people say, oh, but you can lose your life and you can kill granny. It's not my place to answer all those questions at this point. Just from my personal view, I want to get back out. I want rugby to happen. I want people to get that feeling like we've spoken about in their lives, because they're missing the opportunity potentially. And rugby as a sport is maybe missing existing. It might not exist much longer if we don't get back out on those pitches. You know, the cobwebs will gather, people will not give a shit anymore, the fire will go. We need to throw the wood back on the fire in people's stomach and get them going again. And like I say, you're playing these adapted rules games, that's fantastic. We've made the decision to do a long pre-season. The guys are working fucking hard at the moment that we've got there, working really hard, flipping tires, etc. We're working on that power base, you know, and play some games in July pre-season and we finish off. But alongside that, we've got the 99s, and you know, it's exciting, man. It is. This whole thing's exciting. Like I say, we're chasing those feelings, and I think there's a really good opportunity for them to come back with this stuff. It's going to be fun. And then, like I say, hopefully in September we come back to the regular season as and well, and we look back on this COVID shit and it's not a thing anymore. Not a problem.
We can hope.
And hope we shall.
That's a long one. I think that's going to be a good, probably like 2.5 hours, maybe. I imagine we'll have to cut a little bit of it out, but who will know? You will see when you listen to this how long we are. I think it's been a good one, though. Like you say, a bit of therapy, I think.
Yeah.
Talking it out. And
didn't realise this was needed. You suggested this episode kind of like the other day, sort of thing. Oh, should we talk about, like, you know, we said, oh, what topics have we got on this week? There's nothing really big out there at the moment, but there's all these topics we can talk about. But I don't think we fancied talking about, like, you know, steroids and rugby or something like that. We've had a lot of serious sort of conversations like that. It was maybe it's a little bit self-indulgent, this episode, but it was something you suggested. Oh, why don't we talk about, like, our journey and stuff like that? And I'm like, yeah, maybe people will be interested. Maybe people will draw parallels with this. Maybe they won't. If people feel the same way and they've got that kind of gap in their lives, maybe at the moment, reach out, talk to someone. Mental health is so big at the moment. You know, we're lucky that we've got each other and some really amazing friends out there that we've made through sport and universities and stuff like that. And yeah, if you don't have that, we're here to reach out to. If you're listening wherever you are in the world, whether it's, you know, even if you don't speak English and you're thinking, what the fuck are these guys saying? Because we don't speak great English anyway. It's hard probably to get fully what we're on about. But get in touch, talk to us, you know. Let us know. Let us know what your thoughts are. Let us know if you have any questions about stuff. Do you want to hear the unspeakable story from Canada? Do you want to hear about some of the characters we've met over the years? You've heard about some of them, but do you want to learn more about Diesel Dave Haybrock, HD146 himself? We've got plenty of stories. Shout up if you're interested, or if you have stories of your own, share them with us. And yeah, other than that, I guess that's not much more else to say.
So thank you for listening for this kind of, I guess, personal episode. Yeah, thanks for indulging us. I guess for those who, the odd listeners who don't know us in real life, you know, you've learned a little bit more about us, and probably the people who do know us in real life, we probably learned a little bit more too.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thanks a lot for listening. We really appreciate it. Keep your eye out on the social media. There's some big things coming. Bye for now.
Goodbye.